from the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening or good morning, as the case may be, wherever you are. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Art Bell. Well, batten down the hatches. I've got Chris Ruddy coming on, and boy, has he got news for you. There's going to be a news conference tomorrow, and we're going to do a follow-up to what we reported the other day with regard to the ongoing investigation of the Ron Brown situation. You recall Colonel Cogswell. Well, we'll find out what happened to Colonel Cogswell, and guess what? Now, another U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel is coming forward. So this investigation goes up several notches. All of a sudden, we will get the details from Chris Ruddy in a very few moments. I would like to enlist the help of my audience, if possible, with something. We're trying to get a copy of a program, and it may be that one of you out there just happened to tape it. If so, we would like a copy of it. It is some kind of shortwave program that runs on something called AmeriNet. I guess I'm not really sure what AmeriNet is. I guess it's on satellite, some satellite channel, and runs on shortwave. And it would have been the Ted Gunderson show, or a show with Ted Gunderson and some guest named Dave. And we don't know a whole lot more about it than that, but if anybody out there happens to have a copy of that, if you happened to tape it, then please do one of the following things. Send me email immediately with your phone number at artbell@aol.com. That's artbell@aol.com. Failing that, fax me your phone number at area code 702-727-8499. That is my fax number, area code 702-727-8499. And again, what we're looking for is an audio tape copy of what ran on this AmeriNet satellite channel earlier today on the Ted Gunderson show with a guest named Dave. And if that won't do it, let me give you our network's phone number. As a last resort, you could get hold of our network by calling area code 541-664-8829. That's 541-664-8829. And I would very much appreciate the help of anybody out there who might have a copy of that program. Christopher Ruddy was here just a few days ago. Christopher Ruddy is a investigative reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. He has recently begun looking into the Ron Brown situation, and we will quickly review where we were up until today with Chris. Chris, welcome to the program.
Well, Art, a pleasure being on with you again.
And I think you're in Washington, D.C. this night.
I am.
Do you ever rest?
I don't believe in it. It's against my religion.
All right. Let us review very quickly what we said the other night for those who might have missed that program. In other words, bring us up to date to that night, if you would, please.
Well, sure. I'll just go through the articles that I've written in the past 2 weeks. The first one was just questions about this crash where the we were told originally when that plane went down with Ron Brown and 34 others on April 3rd, 1996, that the weather was terrible. It turned out the weather was quite good. The White House, the Pentagon, quickly said it was an accident before any Americans got to the scene. One wonders how they were able to reach that conclusion. The maintenance chief for the airport died mysteriously of a gunshot wound several days after the crash. The authorities immediately ruled suicide. We never really found out exactly what was wrong with the navigational beacons for the airport because the knowledge of those matters died or went with him in his untimely death. The basic or main report last week was that an Air Force Force Lieutenant Colonel named Steve Cogswell, who was part of the Brown death investigation. He's a forensic pathologist, an armed forces medical examiner. He was in Croatia at the crash site.
Right.
That he has alleged that there was an apparent gunshot wound to the very top of Secretary Brown's head.
A round, precisely round hole, approximately 45 caliber in size.
Right. And that it was located and discovered at Dover Air Force Base when Brown's body and the others were brought back to the United States. And Cogswell has alleged that there was additional evidence, in addition to this very circular hole, which is typical of a gunshot, the wound was inwardly beveling, which meant that it got wider as you went deeper, that the first X-ray showed fragments of a possible bullet or metallic items in the brain, that they destroyed the first X-ray, they recalibrated the X-ray machine to reduce these white materials that were in the brain and in the image. They never conducted an autopsy. And when that report came out, just discussing and detailing these items that Cogswell had been discussing in professional lectures and seminars he had been giving to forensic pathologists around the country, to members of the FBI at the FBI Academy taking training courses, I reported that he had been making these allegations. And the world hit the fan for him. The Army and the military quickly stepped in, and he was told that he should not talk to the press. He was given a letter informing him he was under internal investigation.
I should add for my audience that we still have photographs on my website of the hole in Ron Brown's head and of the X-rays that you're referring to, obviously not the kind of quality that you have. And again, folks, these X-rays show, I don't want to put words where they ought not be, Chris, so stop me, but a fragmenting of a bullet consistent, a fragmenting of metal consistent with the breakup of a bullet in his brain.
And sometimes they refer to this as a lead snowstorm.
A lead snowstorm.
And
great.
It's left socket. Brown's left eye socket, behind it you see maybe 20 or so white flecks, and that would be consistent with metal. They're a little bit small for a bullet, but they should have been investigated. In other words, the head should have been opened, and they should have examined what was in there. But they didn't. And in fact, what they've done here, now that the news has come out on this case, is they've turned the guns on Cogswell, put him under investigation.
Well, the day after we did the program, Chris, I began to hear that they were somehow silencing Cogswell. Precisely what steps did they take?
Well, they informed him that he wasn't to talk to the press, for starters. Then they told him he couldn't leave his office during the workday. He couldn't speak to the press during the workday or anyone on a non-professional basis on his phone, that he couldn't leave his floor, that he essentially had to stay at his desk all day, and if he wanted permission to go to lunch, he needed authorization to do that. One of the officers there told me this was tantamount to house arrest. If you're told you have to stay in your home all day, that's house arrest. This was office arrest, and it's unheard of for a ranking military officer who really has done nothing wrong. And they are encouraged, the various medical examiners that worked at the Armed Forces Institute, to give these lectures on previous cases. And they use previous case materials and discuss the matters before the public, and it's in their interest to learn and develop lecture material. So instead of following up on the problems in the case, they turned on him. They also demanded that he turn over his slides and photographs. And on Friday, police arrived at his office, one of whom escorted Lieutenant Colonel Cogswell to his home.
What?
Yeah, didn't you know about this?
No.
Oh, yeah, he was ordered to his home, military escort. They told him they were going to search his home for the photos and slides. And
of course he's in the military, so I suppose UCMJ applies, but this was a civilian home off base.
Yeah. and he went into his door and he actually slammed the door on the military officer at his door.
Yeah, good for him.
And he said, "I'm not letting you in here. I'll get the materials." And the military officer was banging the door. "You better let me in." He said, "Well, why should I let you in? You don't have a warrant."
Right.
And the military officer says, "Well, I'm actually concerned about your safety. I know you have firearms in there, and I wouldn't want you to hurt yourself." Can you imagine?
Oh, my God.
I guess they didn't want him ending up like Admiral Border, right?
Yeah.
So Cogswell opened the door and said, "Look, you can come in and watch me collect the material, and I will hand it to you." And this is a high-ranking military officer again.
How high-ranking was the officer that came to his door? Do you know?
A military police officer.
Military police.
Yeah, Air Force police.
What right do they have to do that? And under what auspices were they demanding this?
They didn't present him with a warrant. Now, again, the military code is slightly different, but I still think that there are certain rights that even military personnel have about how their privacy can be invaded.
Now, why did Cogswell have the photographs? Let's go over that so everybody knows. Cogswell was in possession of photographs of the X-rays that we've been talking about. The picture, I guess the photograph with the hole in Ron Brown's head.
Sure. Well, the forensic pathologists typically go around the country at different conferences discussing the cases they've worked on. And it's a way for all of these experts to develop their own techniques and improve their work. And they have been encouraged at the armed forces. They're ordered to oftentimes to develop case work lectures.
Sure.
And they go back over the previous cases. And this was a lecture series that Cogswell had put together entitled Mistakes and Failures in Forensic Pathology. And this was, now Cogswell's been involved in over 100 crashes. He's 12 years a forensic pathologist. And he figured this was one of the more prominent cases. And here you had evidence of a possible homicide where there definitely needed to be an autopsy. What he did was he got the photographs that are available. And they had photographs of the X-rays. See, when they bring the body in, they put it under an X-ray machine, and they take the X-rays. They take the X-rays, they put them up on a light box and analyze them.
Right. I've seen everybody who's been in a doctor's office has seen that light box with X-rays hanging on it.
Right. So the photographer that's doing the photography work there at Dover Air Force Base takes pictures of the X-rays. So now you have the X-rays, and you have a photograph of the X-rays. Well, when they destroyed that first X-ray with the lead snowstorm, they forgot that they had already taken a picture of it. And so Cogswell asked the photography unit for a copy of the photo. And
can I back up and ask why the X-ray was destroyed?
Well, according to one of the people at Dover, it wasn't Cogswell, but I did speak to someone there, that there was a discussion and that they noted that there was a lead snowstorm. So they decided that they were going to destroy it. Recalibrate the X-ray machine with a lower density to hide those materials.
Even right at that point, if that's true, that constitutes a crime.
Well, you said it. I didn't.
Destruction of evidence of would be, in other words, if they were specific. No, what you said was, you said that they noted there was a, quote, lead, what is it?
Snowstorm.
Snowstorm, thank you. And that they didn't want to have. Now, if it was really there and not just a byproduct or an artifact because sensitivity was set too high somehow or another, then the destruction of that would, under those circumstances, constitute a crime.
They admit the first one was destroyed now. They're saying that what happened was there was a defect in the reusable X-ray cartridge.
Ah.
And they had to do several X-rays to...
Okay, so they're claiming then that it was a, as I just suggested, some sort of artifact of the machine being too sensitive or whatever.
Whatever wrong with the cartridge. They said it had to deal with the cartridge. I spoke to someone who was present who said that the discussion was the fact there was a lead snowstorm and they needed to retake it to remove that. I mean, it was as point blank as that.
Well, if it was, then it would constitute a crime.
Well, I think it's very, very serious, especially if there was something wrong here where, I mean, we don't know if this was a gunshot. We don't know if it was a gunshot, where it went and where it was fired before the plane crashed, during the crash, after the crash. I think the bottom line, what Consuelo is trying to point out is here you have the Secretary of Commerce, high-ranking federal official, lying dead on a table in the examination, and you see what appears to be a gunshot wound.
Yeah.
A very perfectly circular hole. Now you have an X-ray. The man needs an autopsy. Open the body up, do the autopsy, rule out the possibility of the bullet.
It screams for an autopsy.
They don't, yeah, and they don't do it, and then instead they destroy the X-rays.
They destroy the X-rays.
And we later learn, Cogswell alleged...
it was a military photographer who took the pictures of the X-rays?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And then how did Cogswell come to be in possession of those copies of those photographs, and are those the only copies?
Well, he came into possession because he asked for copies or slide negatives to be made of the original photographic negative relating to the Brown case. And so he had a file of X-rays, slides, which he was showing at these conferences. That's how he came into contact with it. Now, what's happened is, maybe we're going a little fast forward here, is that now we have evidence that all the X-rays, the head X-rays, the ones that were on the light box,
yeah,
they're all missing.
Missing.
Even the ones they took.
Missing.
The new reusable cartridge.
You're saying in a high profile, this even the new X-rays are missing. In this
X-ray.
Kind of high profile case, how can that be?
Well, that's a good question. And then we learn that the original negatives, uh-huh, negatives that were used to make copies for Cogswell, and I had gotten a copy.
Yes.
They're now missing. They have no head X-rays in the negative. So what happens is Cogswell is treated terribly here for doing nothing. The Air Force doesn't, the Armed Force Institute of Pathology, they don't go after the original pathology doctor and start asking him what happened to the X-rays.
They go after Cogswell.
They go after the messenger. Kill the messenger, right? Because the American public might find out something. And this all starts happening the day after the AP put it on the wire. So I think they were trying to keep Cogswell somewhat intimidated and hopefully intimidating others. But I think they overreached because that weekend, I got a call from another lieutenant colonel.
We'll get into that in a moment. I have in front of me tonight a UPI story that just broke. I guess probably around, let's see, would have been around 10:21 p.m. Eastern time. Have you yet seen that?
Well, I've heard about it.
All right. Well, I've got it here. So hang tight. Chris Ruddy is my guest. And now we have not one, but a second officer coming forward. This is an absolutely incredible story. And by the way, if you're in the press, please stand by, because there is going to be a full-blown news conference later today in Washington, D.C. That's why Chris Ruddy is there now. And so what you're about to hear is a precursor to that. You're going to hear it before the press hears it in the morning. It's the Ron Brown case, and it is becoming ever more complicated by the moment. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nine.
That's exactly.
Now again, here's Art.
Interrupting my own announcer. Great. That's exactly who I am, and my guest, of course, is Chris Ruddy, and the story continues in a moment. All right, here it comes. United Press International, Dateline Pittsburgh, December 9, UPI. A published report says a second Armed Forces medical examiner says the corpse of Commerce Secretary Ron Brown seemed to have a bullet hole in the top of the head. The Pittsburgh Tribune Review reports U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel David House, is it House?
Haas.
That's H-A-U-S-E. Says he saw an apparent bullet wound in the head, supporting the account of forensic pathologist examiner Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Steve Cogswell, according to the report. Haas, and Cogswell, both members of the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, participated in the agency's investigation of the April 96 military jet crash in which Brown and 34 others died. Now, it goes on and on and on. It's a long story. I'll stop there. But, Chris, why has this lieutenant colonel now, so late, decided to also come forward? What made that decision for him, do you think?
Well, I think that the treatment of Cogswell hit a nerve in him. And the reason why he's never seen anything quite like this, he's been a career professional in pathology. He knows that the Armed Forces Institute has forever directed its members to discuss cases and to lecture on cases. And that's all Cogswell has done in this case. He's discussed and detailed the problems in the Brown case. And this was never off limits. And I think, you know, when you're in the military that long and you see something, maybe there were a series of incidents, but apparently he was concerned enough about this that he came forward to me and said that, yeah, he had been present at Dover Air Force Base. He was two examination tables away from where Brown's body was when it was brought in. And he heard a commotion. They were all talking about a gunshot wound. And Colonel Haas went over, examined it, and said, yeah, it looked like a .45 caliber or something close to it. Entrance wound at the very top of the head. Now, let's remember and point out that Cogswell was in Croatia at the time the examination took place.
Right.
He came back. He was told by the pathologist that did the autopsy, Dr. Gormley, that it may have been a gunshot or appeared to be a .45 caliber possible gunshot, but could he find a piece of the aircraft in Croatia that it would explain it? And Cogswell comes back and looks at the photos and finds out about the x-ray and is just baffled about what happened and the fact they didn't do an autopsy. Well, apparently Dr. Haas was actually there at Dover, and he went over. Now, Haas has been involved with autopsies since 1972. He was a Purple Heart winner from Vietnam, U.S. Army machine gunner. He was a police officer for a while. Then he went back into med school and the Army, became an officer, rose through the ranks. He was the chief combat surgeon for the Gulf War, medical examiner for armed forces in Germany. This guy knows gunshots. He's one of the authorities in the office.
God, this is a big story, Chris. I've got to ask this, Chris.
Sure.
In a case such as this, now, Ron Brown was a civilian. I'm not familiar with autopsy procedures, but wouldn't this be sufficient reason, no matter what the relatives might say with regard to an autopsy, to absolutely proceed without question?
Well, certainly in the case of Brown, because Brown was a member of the cabinet.
Yeah.
He wasn't a member of the military. But because he was a member of the cabinet, he's covered under what's known as the Presidential Assassination Statute, which gives the Armed Forces Institute essentially jurisdiction over the president and cabinet members. They're supposed to, if there's a suspicious death of the president, it's the Armed Forces Institute that is prepared to do this autopsy. And in fact, some of them were preparing and thinking, you know, here we have a cabinet member, this is the first high-ranking suspicious death that we have to examine since the presidential assassination statute was put into effect in the 60s.
Yes.
And this was going to be the dry run for preparing for the death of a president under tragic or violent circumstances. And they screwed it up, apparently, or decided they weren't going to do the proper thing. And, in fact, they didn't even bother doing an autopsy. And it's a very bizarre set of circumstances, but Haas, and I think that the point here, too, we have to underscore, you've been in the military.
Yes.
You're an Air Force guy.
Air Force medic, actually.
Right. But you know, career military officers don't do this unless they feel an urgent, pressing need.
I absolutely agree. This officer, in fact, both officers really knew what they were risking.
Absolutely. And I think they're what their words indicate are far more than what they're even saying. And people say, well, what are they getting so excited over? There's a hole in the head. There was a plane crash. These are trained pathologists. They've worked in hundreds of plane crashes. They have never seen a wound like this before.
Well, even all of that aside, the treatment of Cogswell since, and now the second officer coming forward, all of this, the missing x-rays, all of this would lead one to be suspicious no matter what.
Well, Haas's job last week, and I think this played into why he called me, was he went through the case file for Brown, and they laid out the original negative film in the case file. So these were the sort of the x-rays that were put up in the light box, or they were the original negatives from that. And they examined it, and he found that, indeed, there were no head x-rays left. They were all gone. He went into the safe of the photography department, and he was to inventory all the photo negatives. They're missing all of the head photo negatives for the x-rays. They're gone. So he has now confirmed what Cogswell was saying, that the x-rays have all disappeared. And I think it really underscored in his mind, you know, why is Cogswell being hung out to dry? He had nothing to do with the missing x-rays.
So it sounds to me like he just got pissed off when he heard what was happening to Cogswell.
I think so, but it would be unfair for me as a reporter to characterize it that way.
No, I
think
do
he's
that.
A professional, and I think that there is a concern here that he said that there needed to be an autopsy. Now, he didn't examine the x-rays, Haas. He said that he left it up to the pathologist that did, and it's usually hard not to miss a 45.
Sure. Chris, of the photographs that you've got of the x-rays, have you yet had an opportunity to let a pathologist independently look at them?
Well, I've had not only a pathologist, the former Army wound ballistics expert to look at it.
And?
Well, it's hard to rule it, a bullet. There is something there. There's flecks of possible metal, could be something. They're a little bit small for what you would typically expect for a gunshot. Cogswell says that a handgun shot. But still, you'd have to open up the head to find out what it is. You don't destroy the x-ray. The other thing is, and this is really the key point, the pathologist that did the examination said it was definitely not a gunshot because, he said, the bone in the skull, yes, there was a circular hole, yes, it looked like a gunshot wound, but he noticed that the bone of the skull did not break into the brain, that you couldn't see the brain, that all it had done was whatever hit the head had just depressed the skull in a little bit, indented it, maybe we would say. So that doesn't, he said it didn't go anywhere.
Okay, but that's rather inconsistent with x-rays showing a lead, a whole bunch of lead or a whole bunch of metal inside the head.
Well, not only that, today we published another x-ray, a side x-ray of Brown's head in the Tribune Review, and what it shows is that this bone plug, as the object came in, actually did push into the brain and under the skull.
Really? Did you say that photograph is up there now?
It's in the Tribune Review today, so it should be accessible.
Okay, you would give us permission to put
it
on our website. Keith, go get it.
And if you can hook it up to your website, that would be great.
Probably within the next 10 minutes.
And here's the other thing. We have what Gormley didn't know when he was telling me this. And he said to me, if you could see the brain and it did go into the brain, then that would be a problem. That would be really bad. But what he didn't know at the time was that I have the x-rays or photo negatives of them or photographs of them, and that I had the photograph of the wound, the hole. And in the bullet hole or the apparent bullet hole, you can see visible brain. And Cogswell says you can see visible brain. He says the x-ray shows. I took it to independent experts. They all said you can see the brain, and it's clear that that penetrated the skull. And what's incredible now is that Lieutenant Colonel Haas said he personally examined it at the site, and all he could see was the brain. It cut right through whatever it was. And you don't get a perfectly cylindrical hole, a perfect circle like that, unless it's something of extremely high velocity, much higher than you would get in a plane crash.
Well, asking, okay, on the one hand, they're saying the bullet didn't penetrate, but on the other hand, we've got the x-rays showing the fragments in the brain. If you were to ask a pathologist, what kind of condition would a person be in who suffered the trauma shown in this picture of an x-ray internally in the brain, what kind of answer would you get?
Well, I think what a pathologist would like to see is larger fragments, typically for a bullet. They'd also like to open it up and find out what is there. Sometimes there are problems with the x-ray machines. one of the problems is the side x-ray was overexposed. So it's very hard to pick up if there, because the side x-ray should sort of show, if the frontal x-ray is correct, that there are fragments in the head, the side x-ray should also show fragments. But other than the bone plug, it's hard to see anything in skull fractures and fracture lines in the skull because they overexposed that x-ray.
Okay, let's go back to the language when they were all standing around the table. That's,
sure.
That seems critical to me, Chris. In other words, no matter whether the bullet, he was shot or not shot, if they thought he had been shot, if at that moment, with him, with Brown on the table, they were concluding that there was lead in his brain, and they actually, can you tell me who uttered the words that we're, you know, if we're going to have to destroy these?
Well, I don't think anyone ever used the word, let's destroy the x-ray. But they were, the initial one was destroyed. And.
Well, the order.
I right now I'm not printing, but I may have a story in the future. Who said that there was a lead snowstorm and let's, that's why it was replaced, certainly. But there is a witness there that did overhear that.
Where do we go from here with this, Chris? Do we exhume?
Well, I think there really needs to be an exhumation. I don't know if anyone has the guts. There's a lot of people quaking in their boots over this story. And, you know, it's very clear cut. It's not right-wing agenda. It's not anti-Bill Clinton. It's not.
Well, as a matter of fact, Chris, you know me, and I haven't been doing a lot of political anything for years now, 2-3 years. And I don't frequently do it, but because I consider, frankly, an awful lot of the nonsense in Washington to be utterly irrelevant to the lives of most American people. But this is a horse of a different color. There's no question about it. I mean, this is very, very serious. And
yeah,
their reaction to it is what bothers me as much as anything else. There could be a dispute, of course, about, you know, an injury to the head that kind of looked like a bullet wound. But their reaction to this is not consistent with people who have nothing to fear.
Right, and the actions of the investigators after they find this apparent bullet hole and the failure to do an autopsy, the missing x-rays.
Not consistent with a professional at all.
Right, and it just raises the red flag and possibilities of cover-up come to mind and things like that. I think it is very, very serious, and there's a big problem here that they're not going to get around. And there may have to be another autopsy. There wasn't a first one.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people, some people, after you were on last time, faxed me incredulous, saying, why would anybody bother to shoot somebody who was about to die in a plane crash?
Well, see, what people are doing is they're not handling this as an investigator would, which is first determine if there is a bullet in the head, then try to figure out what happened. It's not the job of someone sitting there after the fact to say, oh, it couldn't happen. We know there have been cases in this country where planes have gone down, they found bullet holes, where there was a struggle on the plane or terrorists or sabotage. There were several people on that plane that had handguns. Handguns were missing from the crash site afterwards.
Really?
There was, oh, yeah, the first American rescuer on the scene noticed there was a handgun out of the holster, and he said it shouldn't have fallen out, that somebody had looted it and stolen it. People might have been fired. There could have been a firing of weapons after the crash. So certainly we shouldn't rule out any possibility here. We just have a bullet hole or apparent bullet hole in the head of someone that needs to be investigated. And without pointing the fingers at anyone and saying anyone murdered another person, you say there's a potential of homicide.
Yes.
And then you need to further investigate it. I've gotten a number of people have said to me, well, 45 or something similar, 40, if that's fired into your head, you have an exit wound, and there was no exit wound here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, remember where the bullet comes in. It comes in, put your finger at the very top of your head.
Yes.
Okay, at the very crown, apex of the head, they call it the vertex. It went, if it was a bullet, it went straight in, down towards the neck.
I understand. So I see what you're saying, sure.
It could have gone anywhere in the body cavity. It wouldn't have flown out the right side of the face or the left side of the face. It wouldn't have blown apart the head.
Right.
And there needed to be, that's why the x-rays are so critical in a case like this. And as I'm going to discuss tomorrow, Cogswell said there was an anomaly of something possibly metallic down in the pelvis area.
In the pelvis area. And so, in other words, obviously in the chest and the pelvis, somewhere a bone or a portion of our lower anatomy could have stopped the bullet.
Well, sure. I mean, the flesh and all of that does slow the bullet considerably. For it to get as far as the pelvis is very unusual. Usually it goes about 15 to 20 inches. So it should have been somewhere in the neck or chest or somewhere like that. It could also have exited the body and created a small exit wound out of an armpit or in the crotch or something like that. And you have to look. And Cogswell claims that they didn't really look carefully. I don't think they wanted to find something they didn't want to find.
You know, that's astounding, Chris. You're going to have a press conference later today, Washington time. Where and when?
Well, at 11:15 in the morning at the Willard Hotel, downtown Washington. And basically what I'm going to do is show on videotape the various slides that Cogswell has been showing on the Brown case. And with it, play a recording of an interview I did by telephone with him where he explained what the various images mean and indicate just as he would in one of his lectures. Now, it's only open to members of the press that have credentials and no cameras are allowed. And, of course, a lot of the photos are extremely graphic of the body and graphic crash scenes. And so people should... any press that are coming, obviously, discretion is advised.
All right, 11:15 a.m., Washington, D.C., at the Willard Hotel. Where is that, Washington?
Which is right down 14th and Pennsylvania.
Okay, and this would be for credentialed press only.
Right. And it would last about an hour, his lecture on my recording. And it basically lays out the evidence as he saw it, and that seems to be confirmed now by a second lieutenant colonel in the Air Force.
Yes, all right. We know what has happened to Cogswell so far. Nothing good. What about Haas? What kind of treatment has he received? Do you know?
Well, I don't think anything immediate. I think they realize they went too far with Cogswell, and they're being careful now and a little bit cagey rather than blowing this thing up out of proportion in their mind or alerting the press.
Too late.
I think it is a little too late, but they basically, I understand they told Haas that he should have cleared the interview with the Public Affairs Office. They haven't said anything that we know of taking any administrative steps, but they could always do that later. They may be waiting. And obviously there may be other people that will come forward in the next week or so.
If somebody else wants to come forward, how do they get hold of you?
Well, they can call me in Pittsburgh at the Tribune Review, which is 412-834-1151, 412-834-1151. And another neat way to get a hold of me, of course, is through my web page and to read these articles, which also I think we hook into your page, is www.ruddynews, R-U-D as in David, D as in David, Y, ruddynews.com. And I might also, my publisher will be very happy, remind people that I have a book in bookstores now, not on this case, but it has a lot of parallels in a strange way, called The Strange Death of Vincent Foster, about what I allege was a cover-up of the Vince Foster death. And there seems to be a lot of eerie similarities. Although, in this case, you know, some people have said, well, why do you want to weaken your credibility claiming there's a bullet hole in Ron Brown's head and all of this? Well, in this case, it's even stronger than the Foster case because here we have the x-rays, the photos, and we have people that examine the body or in part of the investigation ranking individuals saying there's a problem here.
No question about it. There is a problem here. Chris, please give me a call after the press conference tomorrow.
I'll let you know what happened.
And thank you for being there.
Thank you.
Stay there. Take care, Chris.
Bye-bye.
That's Chris Ruddy. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
This is Coast to Coast AM from the Kingdom of Nye with Art Bell.
That would be me, and coming up in a moment, we've got a fellow named Neil Slade. And, oh my, what an interesting topic we're about to dive into. It's called the Frontal Lobes Handbook, and it's about our brains, one of the things about which we know least. So he'd be the guy. He's actually written two other books called Have Fun, Mind Music, and now The Frontal Lobes Handbook. So things like why we only use 10% or less of our brain, why some people appear to be able to do things that other people can't, precognition, telepathy, clairvoyance, telekinesis, that sort of thing. Perhaps how you can do it, how our brain developed. And the first topic, which is really intriguing, called Popping Your Frontal Lobes, The Big Bang. No reference to last hour. Our brains. Neil Slade, composer, musician, artist, author. His music, as a matter of fact, has been heard by millions in his PBS movie soundtrack for Still, and as music for the Kodak United States Traveling Exhibition. He has given concert performances at places like the Gerald Ford Amphitheater, the U.S. Air Force Academy, a graduate in music and education. He's taught music and art for 23 years, was an assistant to brain and behavioral researcher and former NBC television personality TDA Lingo for 11 years. Slade also maintains an extensive worldwide website, and you can get to it by going to my website right now. We had an absolutely shocking hour last night with, this night rather, last hour, with Chris Ruddy with regard to the Ron Brown information, and those photographs are now on my website. All you've got to do is go down, for example, to Neil Slade's name in the guest area and click on his name on the link and you will go to Neil's website. So let us now go to Neil Slade. Neil, where are you?
I'm in Denver, Colorado.
Denver, welcome to the program. Glad to have you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be a part of one of the few dependably intelligent and imaginative talk show discussions.
Well, it's certainly, you know, we're different, all right. I've got to start, I guess, at the beginning, and this must be the beginning. Discussion topics, you sent me a little list.
Sure.
Popping your frontal lobes, the Big Bang.
Okay.
What in the world?
Well, we're going to talk about something here that's been a well-kept secret in this region. As you mentioned, I worked with a behaviorist TDA Lingo for over a decade, and he has received a fair amount of attention in the Rocky Mountain Press here about the work that he did for 35 years. And you are, in fact, the first nationally broadcast media person to break this story. So your listeners are in for a very unique experience tonight. I want to, right up front, make very clear that some of the things that we're going to talk about may seem very extraordinary. People may not believe upon hearing that they can turn on their own pre-existing circuits for extrasensory types of activities. They may not believe at first that they can easily communicate with alternative reality entities. But, you know, I'm really a down-to-earth person. I still continue to teach grade school kids. I've taught in the public schools. I teach privately. So, you know, I'm not about to make claims that are, you know, ridiculous. These have been the things that I will describe have been my own personal experience, as well as the experiences of hundreds of people who have been a part of the Brain Lab here in Colorado, Lingo's Brain Lab.
All right. You and I talked briefly, and I think you may have heard a segment or I described a segment to you. We were talking about precognition.
Sure.
Now, I've had one thing in my entire life happen to me, only one, just one, but it was a doozy.
Yeah.
And I think I've told my audience about it, and I don't want to be repetitive, but I'll briefly give the explanation,
sure.
Okay? here I was in Santa Barbara working in radio at the time for KDB in Santa Barbara, as a matter of fact, at that time, and not my present affiliate, I had to add. And I had come home after work at the radio station, and I was sitting on the couch in a garden-type apartment. Now, you may be familiar with the type of apartments that they have large sliding glass doors that go out to a little balcony type affair. And we had that, and we were on the ground floor. And I parked my car in front of, around the sidewalk, you know, up to the sidewalk, right in front of my window. It seemed a logical place. A, it was the closest to my residence. I could just go up a little walkway. Second, obviously, having it, close by was good for a number of reasons. So that's where I parked. And I came home, sat down, watched TV, and I was in the middle of the evening news, consuming it as usual, and this wave came
relaxing,
over me.
Relaxing, in a kind of a relaxed state?
Well, sure, as compared to being at work or, you know, the buzz of the day, whatever. I mean, I'm relaxing watching the news, as
right.
relaxing as I can be.
Sure.
And it was like ocean waves crashing over my mind, telling me something was wrong with, something terribly was wrong with my car.
Incidentally, what do you recall what portion of your head you felt these sensations, out of curiosity?
What I can recall is that it was an all-consuming feeling. In other words, I couldn't say, you know, it was
no
the
particular
upper right-hand part of the brain or anything. This thing was like it was washing over the totality of me.
Over the top of your head.
Over the totality of me. Now, I don't know, just in waves over my whole body. I wouldn't even, I have said my head,
okay.
frankly, right. over my whole body, just washing over me. And it was saying something's wrong. And I uttered something that I can't repeat here because I was annoyed. And I walked over and I pulled the curtains and I looked at my car. And it was cool. It was fine. I was very proud of it. It was a 428 Cobra Jet. You know, it was one of those days. I had a big car. And it was fine. And so I said, this is dumb. And I went back and I sat down again and again began to watch the news. And immediately, no time lapse, immediately, here it comes again in wave after wave after wave, causing me to compulsively get up again, utter something else I can't repeat, go back over, spread. This time I pulled the curtains apart and I stood there and I looked at my car. It was fine. Well, 3 or 4 seconds later, here comes a fellow walking from my building, which held many apartments, down the walkway that I described, walked down in front of my car, walked around, got in his car, which was parked directly in front of my car,
uh-huh.
put it in reverse, and slammed into my car. I was so shaken, not by the occurrence of my car being hit, but by the fact that I had known about this, that I fell to my knees. I was that actually, I was in shock, shaken very badly. I had enough sense to get up and to open up the sliding glass door and yell at, hey, I saw that. I've got your license number. And he said, oh, I'm stopping. And it was no big deal. But there is no question about it. I knew something was going to happen. I didn't know that was going to happen, but I knew something was going to happen to my car. It wasn't ambiguous. I couldn't ignore it. I've never had it before. I've never had it since, and I did nothing to bring it on. It's like it came out of the blue, and it went away, and it's never come back. What happened to me?
Very interesting. Well, what happened to you is you accidentally accessed pre-existing circuits in your frontal lobes, or that part of your brain which is able to perceive future events. And at this particular time, since it was the first time it happened to you, it was shocking. You didn't know really, I mean, you were just taken aback by it.
Taken aback is a mild phrase.
Yeah.
I mean, they put me on my knees, and I don't go on my knees easily.
Sure. What is interesting is that you didn't force this, you know, this mental situation. It just happened to you by accident, and that you didn't do anything something extraordinary to cause it to happen. You just almost, you just slipped into this particular frame of mind. And at the Brain Lab, we've come up for a pretty good explanation of why this happens and how any ordinary person can begin to experience this kind of thing routinely. We'll get into that. What's important to start out with is to understand how the brain is basically put together.
All right.
And we'll be putting together a puzzle, as it were. And each piece of the puzzle will eventually form a whole, and then you will see for yourself and understand how and why that happened and how you can regularly make use of that part of your brain.
Let's do it. I understand that we only use, it is said, 10% or less of our brain. Is that a myth? Is that true?
That's a very generous estimate.
It is?
Yes. We have to, scientists have come to the conclusion that the, and we're talking about neurophysiologists, doctors, people across the globe dedicate their lives to understanding the brain. Now, myself, I'm primarily a musician, teacher, so I don't claim to be a neurophysiologist, but I have gathered over many years certain relevant facts that have helped me, and that I'll share with you and your audience.
Well, why were you working with TDA Lingo, who is a behavioral researcher, a brain behavioral researcher? Why were you working with him? How do you go from music to that?
Well, this is how it came about. We have a wonderful television station here in Denver, Channel 12, and shows all kinds of programming that not even our regular PBS station would touch. And one evening, there was they were showing a movie. And the movie started out, when I tuned on in the middle of the program, and it was people talking. They were sitting in the mountains next to log cabins and up in the trees, and it was obvious from the movie that they were like in the wilderness. And they were talking about their brain and all these fantastic experiences that they were having. And one woman was relating how one day she came outside of her tent and she was looking at the arm, and suddenly she could see inside the cells of her arm, and she could perceive the corpuscles moving in and out of the veins of her arm, and she was seeing with a microscopic type of vision. Hmm. And another person was relating
Let me stop you right there.
Sure.
There are people who claim they can diagnose and know what's wrong with another. As a matter of fact, one of my guests coming up tomorrow night is a fellow named Danyon Brinkley.
Yeah.
And Danyon can look at you, touch an article that has come from you, and know your health condition. He can tell you precisely what's wrong with you. Is that the kind of talent you were just describing? Now, I can understand, for example, if you could look inside your arm,
yes,
and you could see its function and innards as you would with an X-ray or MRI, or in this case something apparently even better, such a diagnosis would be entirely possible.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the kind of a talent or ability that somebody like Danyon Brinkley or somebody like that?
It's very interesting that he has this ability, and he's in the business of healing people.
Yeah, oh yes.
The part of the brain that allows us these wonderful psychic, unusual powers that are out of the ordinary, the telepathy and the precognition.
Yes.
These powers are associated with that part of the brain, which is the most evolutionarily advanced part of our brain, which is also not incidentally, associated with cooperative behaviors.
Cooperative
behaviors. Many times people say, well, you know, if you've got precognition, why don't you go pick the lotto numbers and win $1 million?
It's a really good question. Now, in my case, I couldn't repeat it. It's never happened again. Maybe it never will in my life. I don't know. But if I could apply that power, then, yeah, why not, call it up at will and pick the lotto winner? Sure.
As it turns out, I know someone who lives near Las Vegas. And they work at a community service organization,
yes,
a nonprofit organization that helps people in the community.
Yes.
Right? They're not a profitable organization, but they do need funds. And it turns out that this woman is psychic. And whenever the organization needs funds, she drives into Las Vegas and goes around to various casinos.
And
she wins the money that the organization needs to survive and help the community.
You really know that to be true?
Yes. Yes. And the casinos are very familiar with this woman. And
do you know what game she plays?
No, I don't. This was reported to me many years ago.
I am in Nevada, and it is true, Neil. I can tell you there is a list. There's a very specific list of people that, for various reasons, are not allowed in casinos. Period.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blacklist.
Sure.
We have it here in Nevada. Yeah, I wonder if she's on that list.
No, as a matter of fact, the casino owners know her, and they know the work that she does,
yeah,
and they do, in fact, allow her to come in with her winnings. And when she wins the money that she needs for that particular month or months for the community, then she leaves. She isn't greedy. She doesn't win the money for her own personal needs.
All right. We're at the bottom of the hour. This is incredible. I want you to hold on.
Okay.
Neil Slade is my guest, and we're going to take a break here and be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell.
This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It sure is. Neil Slade is my guest, one of my favorite areas of examination. Things that I know we can do, but I can't prove. The story I told you about myself is absolutely, unequivocally true. Now, what it was, I don't know. I think we've got the fellow who's about to tell us. You told us the story of the lady in Las Vegas who, for good reasons, goes and wins money at the casinos.
Mm-hmm.
They know that she's doing something. Now, casinos in Las Vegas watch for card counters.
Right.
They watch for all kinds of people who might be trying to gyp them out of money. But there would be no apparent, at least with the kind of talent you're talking about that this lady has, there would be no apparent thing they could pin on her. They couldn't call her a card counter if she was playing cards.
Well, you know what they do. When someone starts winning an extraordinary amount of money for whatever reason, they spot these people.
Well, they do a number of things. They change dealers, boom, like that.
Yeah.
You know, if you're winning a lot of money, they'll change dealers.
Yeah, but they're aware of when someone is winning a lot of money.
Sure. You bet they are.
Well, I mean, it doesn't go unnoticed.
They've got what's called a pit boss sitting there watching everything that's going on. And so if you're winning a lot of money, you bet they're on you like flies on horsemen.
Yeah, and I think what goes on is that, you know, they know that the work that this woman is doing.
All right, well, that brings us to an obvious question.
Sure.
The talent, is the talent, or is it? I have asked other people who claim to have this talent, and they tell me...
The talent for?
The talent for example, doing what that lady did with Las Vegas.
Paranormal type of abilities in general.
And the typical response is always, well, then give us the winning numbers, the lotto.
Right.
All right, so they tell me, if you use this talent for greedy or wrong reasons, that it doesn't work.
Absolutely. Oh, and it's so clear. I was going to save this part of the discussion till later, but, you know, we can go into it. And
I think it's important. Yeah, it's important, Neil, because the talent ought to be the talent. Why is it restricted to the doing of good?
Okay. I think we do have to touch a little bit about how the brain is basically constructed.
Okay.
So let's start there.
Sure.
Okay. Now, this Dr. Paul McLean worked for many years at the at NIM, the National Institute of Mental Health, and he then went on to his own laboratory of brain research that he set up for his own.
Right.
And what he came up with was a new way of looking at the brain. And let's see what my little date. This was in 1952-ish. Or so. And Dr. Paul McLean realized that the human brain is a triune brain.
What does that mean?
That means three tri-brains in one. Un, triune.
Okay.
Okay. It is a reptilian brain core surrounded by another layer, which is called the mammal brain. Further surrounded by another.
Wait, would that be mammal? Is that what you said?
Mammal. Like,
spell it.
Dogs and cats. M-A-M-M-A-L.
Oh, okay.
Mammal.
Thank you.
Surrounded by another, area called the primate brain. Three layers. A good analogy is, a good analogy for the human triune brain construction is an apple. Now, if you think of the way an apple is put together, at the very inside, you've got these hard seeds.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
That could be compared to the reptilian brain core that a human has.
Right.
If we look at our spine, it comes up and it goes right into the center of the brain. It's the innermost part.
Correct.
Okay?
Yes.
Then, around the hard seeds of an apple, we've got a pulpy type of core, which takes up, say, another 10% of the brain. You know, the seeds are very tiny, but the core makes up maybe 10% of that bulk there.
All right.
Now, around the reptilian spinal cord end, knobby end of our brain, we have this mammal brain, okay? And then we can think of the fruity part of the apple and the final outside shiny coat of the apple as the primate brain. And so in our brain, around this reptilian mammal core, we have the vast bulk of the brain, the gray matter and the white matter, the part of the brain that's all wrinkly, that when we see it a brain, this is what we see, okay? So the human brain is constructed in this way, like an apple.
Okay.
And each one of these sections of our brain has a specific function.
Right. Would you agree, as I listen to you talk about this, it sounds as though you're talking about what would be the process of evolution?
Yes, absolutely. I don't have the number of years memorized, but many, many eons ago, the reptiles first evolved on the planet, and the fish came out of the ocean, if you are to believe in evolution, and the reptiles populated the planet. Okay,
now, right.
This part, these animals, and if we look at reptiles that exist today, the reptile brain computes a certain type of behavior and consciousness. And that type of behavior is 100% competitive consciousness. Okay? The reptile brain.
So wait a minute. Competitive consciousness.
If you look at a reptilian behavior, reptiles are
very competitive.
They're solely competitive. They do not exhibit cooperative.
You're sort of referring to the fight or flight basic instinct.
Yes. Reptile brains in reptiles and in humans, this portion of our brain, computes what scientists refer to as the four F's of behavior. Fighting, fleeing, feeding, and reproduction.
That's an R.
Well, this is family radio station.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Neil. Thank you.
So these are the four F's, okay?
Yeah.
The reptile brain computes me
sure.
type of consciousness.
Sure, sure.
They are only concerned with self-preservation and survival.
And this would have been the first evolution.
This was right. The first reptiles, this is how they survived.
All right. Now, listen, folks, we are intentionally setting Adam and Eve and all that goes with aside for a moment and working with evolution.
Yes.
All right. The second, then, portion of the brain, or next portion of evolution, would be the mammal?
The mammal brain. Correct. Now, as reptiles evolved into more complicated creatures, we saw birds, we saw little small mammals and mice, and this eventually evolved into what we recognize as dogs and cats now. Now, along with the rest of the body that evolved, the brain also evolved.
Right.
And so we have a new layer that was built over the reptilian brain. And it added on additional behaviors. And these behaviors that we find now in mammals, but absent in the earlier reptiles, are behaviors of bringing up the young, of nurturing young. Okay?
Okay?
All of a sudden, we have animals that are caring for others of their species. Now, when reptiles reproduce, they lay their eggs and they split.
Yeah.
Kids, you're on your own.
Yeah.
And we can even use...
you need to say no more. You can then move on to look at dogs and cats and
right.
other...
The mammals add on social behaviors to the basic reptilian survival skills.
That seems clear and logical.
Whereas reptiles were only concerned with the self, now mammals all of a sudden... Well, they don't discard the reptilian behaviors, but they add on another 50% of cooperative consciousness.
Gotcha.
Right? If you look at your dog or cat at home, you know, at least half of the time they're happy to see you. They jump in your lap.
Sure.
They look you in the face when you give them food. And that mammals add play behavior, right?
Yes, correct,
yeah. Of course, if you give them a bone... And then you try to take the bone away, what happens? They suddenly revert into the competitive reptilian behavior.
Well, in some cases.
And in some cases, certainly. If you were, in domesticated animals, this may not be necessarily the case.
If you, even with a domesticated animal, if you seriously began to compromise its food supply, and it saw you taking its food, it would eventually take a piece out of you. There's no question about it.
Yes. There's no logic involved with mammals. And they mammals sort of click between the survival reptilian me consciousness and the cooperative consciousness, sort of like a light switch that's flicking back and forth in the wind, just depending on its environment.
Gotcha.
That will determine whether their behavior is cooperative, play, nurturing, or whether it's competitive reptilian consciousness.
Gotcha.
Okay?
Right.
Now we've taken care of the reptiles and the mammals. Now, 10 million years later, after the mammals first began to develop, the primates developed. And along with this, the neocortex, as it's called, the primate brain, was a large addition to the brain. And eventually we see Neanderthals and Homo sapiens evolve, and the brain gets larger and larger. And what this is a further development of the and refinement of mammal behaviors, okay?
But it's a pretty big jump.
It's a pretty big jump. What's interesting is when you get to human beings, you have even further development of this primate brain, and the whole one-third bulk of the brain, which we have come to know as the frontal lobes, develops. Now, if you look at this frontal lobe area on dogs or cats, it makes up a measly 5% of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to monkeys and apes, all of a sudden it jumps to 17% of the brain. But once you get to humans and dolphins, the very high mammals like dolphins and whales, this frontal lobe area jumps to 29%. Of the neocortex, okay?
Hmm.
And what we have realized is that behaviors that we have recognized as purely human behaviors such as language, abstract thought, planning.
Yes.
These are a result of this new additional parts of the brain that evolved primarily for humans. It's the frontal lobes. And I've come up with a little, I think the word is anagram, where you have a word that stands for a series of other things.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember the show Beanie and Cecil, and but there used to be a cartoon, and this little kid used to wear this beanie, and he would fly all over the place. So you can use the word Cecil, C-I-C-I-L, to describe the functions of this most advanced part of the human brain, the frontal lobes. And the frontal lobes compute creativity, imagination, cooperation, intuition, and logic.
All right.
Now, these are highly advanced skills that appear nowhere else in nature.
Is intuition, in your description, synonymous with precognition, or are they separate things?
precognition, there's a range of abilities. You know, a mother can say, well, I have an intuition, a hunch.
Sure.
That could be, say, on a scale from 1 to 10, level 2, of knowing something but not having any sensory input to really back it up. Where someone who has a highly developed sense of precognition, maybe they're at 9 or 10 with this ability. So there's a whole range of it. Intuition meaning knowledge that one has without having any sensory input
one might describe it, for example, when you thinking back on my experience, as a vague feeling versus an overwhelming, compelling feeling.
You were on scale of 8 or 9 that particular time.
Yeah, at that moment.
Yes.
But I believe me, I've dropped back to a 1.
Well, we'll get you back up there. We'll get you back up there. It's kind of interesting how generally these extrasensory skills, at least from my observations and from the observations at the brain lab, they're not something that that you turn on and off, you know, like you turn your television on or off. It's more, you know, if you think about all of your other senses.
Are you aware of the work being done at Princeton?
Explain this work to me, and I may or may not be.
Well, it has to do with all of these areas, precognition, telepathy, that sort of thing. And then there's a private company called Pear Inc., which is teaching people how to develop these talents. And they have a unique computer program, which is very, very interesting, Neil. Pear Inc. is an offshoot of the work done at Princeton. It's commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows you, it's a random number generator.
Ah, I know what you're speaking of. Sure, go ahead.
You do, right? Mm-hmm. And you can pull down two pictures, one of white noise, which essentially is like what you see on your television when there's no signal, just all the little dots.
Uh-huh.
And you could put that on the right-hand side. On the left-hand side, you could put a picture of a castle. And you start out, and the two pictures will start to sort of interweave with each other. And your job is to try and cause one to resolve over the other. In other words, to completely clear up the picture and cause the castle to be clear, or to completely turn it all into white noise.
Yes.
That program will then grade you on your ability to do that. And I have extensively played with this program, and it is astounding. I can start it off, walk out of the room, not pay any attention to it. The score will come up, inevitably very low, 9, 10, 12, 13, something like that. But if I sit there and concentrate, I can consistently score 65, 75, 85, 95%.
Yes, I find it very interesting. And I think it's something that a lot of people would find useful. And I think probably one of the reasons that it works is that it is a fairly innocuous type of endeavor. In other words,
well,
there's nothing to really win by doing this. It's not something you're not trying to gain monetarily by doing it. You're not trying to.
No, but the implication is incredible, and that is that your mind can affect an operating microprocessor generating random numbers that result in pictures. Now, that clearly is a demonstration of mind over machine.
Yes. Have you ever played the game with coins, where you flip a coin and see if you can influence the number of heads or tails coming up?
That would be a cruder form. No, I've never really played with that. But
that's something that anyone can do, and you don't even need a computer.
Well, in that case, you've got a whole lot of guys who play professional NFL football who would like to talk to you.
But right. But all of a sudden, we're getting into a situation where someone is starting to click into competitive consciousness.
All right.
And
here's where I have the hard time with it.
That we're talking about are purely non-competitive.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes. Why, though, would any negative motivation for wanting to wield this power, most power you can describe in the world, from nuclear power to any other kind of power, has both positive and negative uses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's easy for me to imagine that this power exists, that we have it latent or developing in our brains. It's hard for me to imagine that we can only use it for good and cannot use it for reasons ranging from personal profit to evil.
Sure.
Power is a power. If it's real, it should be able to be wielded for any reason, good or bad. So when we come back after the top of the hour, I'd kind of like to know why it is that when we try to use it for something, personal profit or whatever, it doesn't work. Can you address that?
I certainly can.
Oh, good. Well, all right, that's what we're up to when we come back then. Power, I always thought, could be used for nearly anything. At least it has always been so. Just ask the U.S. military. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
This is Coast to Coast AM from the Kingdom of Nye with Art Bell.
That would be me, and my guest is Neil Slade, and boy, is this interesting stuff for once. He's written a book called The Frontal Lobes Handbook. He's been deeply involved in music for years. However, worked with a brain researcher for years and years and years, TDA Lingo for 11 years. And we're talking about the brain, and we're talking specifically about the ability of our brain to perform seemingly amazing feats, precognition, telekinesis, clairvoyance, that sort of thing, the silent senses, he calls them. And he has developed a kind of a theory with regard to our brain that suggests there are three separate parts, the reptilian or center portion of the brain connected directly to our spinal cord, which cover the four F's, and we'll move through that again. The mammal section, the next section out in the brain, which takes care of nurturing the young and higher functions, of course, than the reptilian portion, which is basically fight or flight and food and reproduction, which is an R instead of an F, but family radio, right? And then the outermost portion, the primate portion, which contains, which includes the frontal lobes of our brain. And all of this makes sense, of course, if you believe in evolution. Now, we are talking about these specific abilities, precognition, for example. I've had that one great example in my life of precognition only once. Maybe I'll have it again someday, who knows, but there was no question about it. It was there. I didn't want it. I couldn't control it. I couldn't stop it, and it has never happened again. He says, at that point, I was operating around a level 8 or 9. Normally, I'm a 1. I don't have precognition. I have a little bit of intuition, but that's way down on the scale compared to precognition. And let me tell you where we are in the discussion. He says there is a lady, for example, in Las Vegas who, for a good cause, will go to a casino and win money, which she then will do good with, in an organization that she represents. But it seems as though you can only do good with this and not bad, and that part doesn't make sense to me, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. There are two stories you should be aware that I'm tracking. One is in Reno, where my affiliate and many, many other people report having seen a red object in the sky. We're trying to get more information on that. If you have it, we would appreciate any input. An ongoing, a fairly serious sighting in the Reno area. And here we go again. The Washington Fire Department finds goo from the sky. Goo. Just this evening on the NBC Portland, Oregon TV affiliate, they reported a person brought the Everett, Washington Fire Department some, quote, goo that fell from the sky following a rain, end quote. The substance, a clear gel, has yet to be identified. And indeed, a year or so ago, I interviewed a lady in Western Washington who also reported this goo stuff. It was, I believe, covered by a network television operation. This goo killed her cat, and there had been a UFO sighting with in connection with that particular report. So I'm looking at both of these stories right now and following them. I've got a lot of other information for you as well, which we'll get out when we're in open lines. But with regard to the sighting in Reno, many, many people apparently saw it, including air controllers who saw this, whatever it was, but did not see it on radar. And the witnesses include personnel at KOH Radio in Reno. So it's a developing story, and I'll keep you informed. Right now, back to Neil Slade. Neil.
Hi.
All right. So this power that we have, Neil, can be used for good, but apparently not for bad. And that mixes me up.
Let me explain that to you.
Okay, go right ahead.
First of all, you have to let me relate this to you. Lingo ran his program for 35 years, starting with young pre-adolescent children who came up for summer camp, and then adolescents, then young adults, and finally adults.
Yes.
And every summer he held a brain and nature course. And what he noticed was a distinct increase in extrasensory abilities reported by subjects who went through the annual brain and nature course. Now, the people who went through the course perform daily routines of various brain exercises and meditations designed simply to increase the amount of creative, intelligent frontal lobes processes, thought processes that we know are a product of frontal lobes types of thinking. Many people came up to the program to find help in dealing with troublesome emotional personal problems, and the summer course was designed to deal with these kinds of problems. So accordingly, as the subjects increase their frontal lobes thought processes and behaviors, and a limited negative mental hang-ups associated with reptilian brain processes, they also reported increased incidences of extrasensory and paranormal activity. Okay? Now, subjects who experience the most pronounced levels of change, known at the lab as popping your frontal lobes, they reported routine occurrences of extrasensory experience. This was also my own personal experience there. So what we have found through trial and error and reports from subjects and also relating the connection between frontal lobes activities and the occurrence of these paranormal skills
yes.
is that the frontal lobes portion of the brain is either the location of these skills, or it somehow, at the very least, is involved in the neural pathways involved in these skills.
All right.
All right.
I still don't have an answer to my question.
I'm coming to that.
Okay.
So we know there is the connection between frontal lobes and these paranormal skills. Okay. Now, the same area of the brain that allows you to use these skills also makes you see the domino effect of your actions. Follow?
Makes you see the domino effect of your actions.
Right. The frontal lobes compute concepts of time. It allows you to see, let's say, if you do action A.
Yeah.
The frontal lobes allow you to compute the results, the resulting chain link of effect of your action.
All right, let us go back then, Neil, to the example of, well, then why not pick the winning lotto numbers?
Well, okay.
My frontal lobes would compute, if I did, I'd win a lot of money and be real comfortable. Now, why would that prevent me from exercising that power in that pursuit?
It's possible. It's possible that you would win a lot of money and give it to charity and so forth.
It's also possible I'd win a lot of money and put it in the bank.
That's right.
So what is it in my brain that would prevent me from winning a lot of money and putting it in the bank?
Okay. Frontal lobe skills come about as a... If you think about all of the senses that you normally use, our regular senses, touch, smell,
right,
taste, auditory, these are senses that aid you in your survival.
Yes.
And in survival of the species.
Yes.
There's a reason for that. They help you to survive.
Right. Put finger in fire, pull away because it hurts, yes.
That's right.
Survival. Finger doesn't burn up.
Okay. Now, if your actions that you take as a result of, let's say, your precognition.
Yes.
Or your telepathy.
Right.
If these actions enhance your ability to survive.
Yes.
And enhance the community's ability to survive, then these abilities are, they become a natural part of your expression. Okay? They are then made available to you. Okay?
I'm not sure.
Well,
whether I'm okay with that or not. In other words, I'm not sure still it answers my question.
Well, I'm getting to that.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Okay. So if you, let's say, you think, okay, I'm going to pick some winning lotto numbers.
Right.
And then I'm going to take that money and I'm going to put it into the bank for me.
Pay off my house, pay off my car.
Right.
Try to do a bit of world travel, you know, that kind
right.
of thing.
Right. When you start thinking in those terms,
right,
you're all of a sudden you're no longer processing frontal lobes processes. You're processing the reptilian me
okay.
types of behavior.
Oh, I see. So
reptiles lay eggs.
I've
okay,
got
so
you.
We use the analogy eggs. Ego, greed,
yep.
grab.
Thank you. Okay, that does answer my question.
You follow?
Right. Yes, of course I do.
That's why the woman in Las Vegas can go, because she's thinking about, I'm going to do something that's going to benefit everybody.
Yes, oh, I understand. Now,
okay.
You have answered my question. Let me ask you another.
Okay.
Scientists really recently have discovered what they are calling, or we are calling, actually, a God spot in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
No joke. In other words, They have determined through actual measurement that when people pray or consider things religious, God, whatever, there is a specific part of the brain, which I can't give you at this moment.
I know the part.
That you do, that becomes active. What part is that?
This is the brain's master click switch.
The brain's master?
Master click switch. This was first discovered by a neurophysiologist named Graham Goddard. And he used electroprobes in white rats' brains and stimulated the anterior front portion of an organ called the amygdala. And let me explain what the function of this is and how we know what it does. As we know, we have a reptile brain,
right?
Okay, and then we have this middle part of the brain, the mammal brain,
mammal
and then
brain.
The frontal lobes.
And the frontal lobes, yes.
Okay. Now, if we think about consciousness in the brain as a sort of a pathway, we could say that consciousness begins in the reptiliar, I believe it's called the reptiliar activating formation. It's in the reptile brain. And there's a little switch in that part of the brain, and when it's clicked off, we're asleep, okay? And when we wake up in the morning, this little switch in this part of our reptile brain clicks on, and the energy flows from our reptile brain out to our mammal brain and then out to our frontal lobes.
Telling us probably something like, my mouth feels like a birdcage, I've got to go brush my teeth, or I'm hungry, or I need some coffee, or whatever.
Right. When we're asleep, our senses are turned off.
Yes. Yes.
Right, and we're not aware of our environment.
Yes.
So it's a motion from inside, from our very innermost core part of our being out to our senses.
Okay.
Okay.
Sure.
Now, there's a switch right in the middle of the brain, and there's one for each hemisphere of the brain.
Each three hemispheres.
Well, the switch is in the mammal portion of the brain, and the mammal portion of the brain is midway between the innermost reptile brain and the outermost primate brain and frontal lobes.
Right.
Okay? And this switch is like a click switch. It's like a light switch.
I understand.
That you turn on and off.
Yep.
Okay? Now, when this click switch, and it's called the amygdala, and that comes from the Greek word meaning almond, because it's a little nut-shaped protuberance inside, right in the middle of our brain.
Okay.
Your audience can find this switch very easily. All you do is you take your fingers, okay, and your index fingers, mm-hmm. and put them about, 3/4 inch in front of each ear, right at the temple,
okay.
and point straight in. And about 1 inch inside each temple is where these switches are located.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one for the right half of the brain, the right hemisphere, and there's one for the left hemisphere of the brain. Okay?
If I give myself a good sharp jog on one side or the other, can I switch it?
If you give yourself a good what?
Jog. Boom. That was a joke, Neil.
Sorry, I missed it.
Sorry.
So this is where the switch is located. Okay? Now, when the switch is clicked backwards,
uh-huh.
Okay, our brain, most of the electrochemical activity in the brain is sent backwards into our reptile brain. And when this switch is clicked forwards, it allows the electrochemical energy of our brain to continue forward into our frontal lobes.
We are now using more of our brain.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. The reptile brain and mammal brain make up 10-15% of the bulk of our brain. And the rest of our brain is this huge primate brain and frontal lobes. Okay?
They are the areas of intense interest for us this night, right?
Yes.
Particularly that outermost portion. All right. Neil, hold on. We'll be right back. We're going to break here at the bottom of the hour.
pretty interesting stuff, huh? Which way do you think your switch is this night? A lot to learn. Stick around. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell, and this is the program that sort of doesn't do the same thing every night. Have you noticed? It's called Coast to Coast AM. And if you'll stick around for a while, it'll be quite an adventure. Don't move.
Now, here again is Art Bell.
Once again, here I am. Thank you very much, Ross. So, the God spot in our brain, an actual area that we're able to measure, that when we think of religion or we pray, is active. We are talking about the human brain. We will begin taking calls shortly. My guest is Neil Slade, and we'll get right back to him. Neil, we need to move ahead fairly quickly here,
sure.
If we can.
Okay.
And I think that I'm pretty clear now on the fact that these abilities that we've been talking about tonight all lie just beyond a switch, in essence.
Yes.
And if we can figure out how to turn on the switch, then precognition, even telekinesis, and a lot of other things begin to be in our arsenal.
Access to internet.
Bad word, I guess, arsenal. Our abilities, if we use them wisely and for good.
Yes.
Now, how do we turn on that switch, Neil?
Well, you know, I recently wrote a book called Have Fun. And what I try to do is make the switching of the amygdala process and turning on the infinite potential of the frontal lobes as simple as possible. And so I started out by saying to the audience, I'm going to explain how you can achieve nirvana in a matter of seconds, and I'll explain this to your audience as well. Okay? Now, the first thing you do is you find a neurosurgeon. Okay?
A neurosurgeon.
A neurosurgeon. And you get him to implant an electrode needle in the anterior, that's the front portion of your amygdala, in the right side of your brain and the left side of your brain.
Total bummer, Neil.
That's the first step. And then secondly, you connect one end of this needle to a variable electrical current output device.
Why not just plug it right into the wall?
Well, you only need a couple of milliamps of power, okay? You turn on the juice and voila! We'll see God instantaneously.
All right.
Okay?
All right.
And this is exactly what scientists did back in the 50s. Now, if you go to your local medical school library, and you can look up the neurobiology of the amygdala or some other books which document these case histories, you'll find that scientists learned what happens when you stimulate the front part of the amygdala and what happens when you stimulate the back part of the amygdala.
Uh-huh.
And the result is exactly the opposite. When the posterior portion of the amygdala is stimulated, it turns on reptilian brain behaviors and the attendant emotional emotions that go along with those behaviors.
Gotcha.
People who click their amygdala backwards become paranoid. They experience fear. They experience the full range of negative emotions and exhibit reptilian fight or flight.
Kind of, sure, I've got you.
Types of behaviors.
Right.
When the amygdala is clicked forward and it sends electrical chemical energy forward into the frontal lobes, they feel peace of mind. And many people have reported cosmic connectedness. As you said it, they see God, okay? And they exhibit attendant frontal lobes behaviors. For example, a cat. Put a mouse in a cage with a cat, and what does the cat do? Cat attacks the mouse and eats it. Now, they did this with the cat, and they clicked the amygdala forward of the cat, because a cat has an amygdala too.
Yeah.
Small frontal lobes.
What did it do? Lick the mouse?
It just watched the mouse deflated and it observed the mouth.
Really?
Jose Delgado,
wow.
1962, attached an electrode to inside a bull's brain. And the bull, they waited for the bull to go into a full charge, and they turned on the juice and clicked the amygdala forward, stopped the bull dead in its tracks. The bull clicked out of reptilian counterattack behaviors and right into cooperative frontal lobe behaviors and calmed down. Now, they did this. They started out doing it in rats, and they went up to cats, and they clicked the amygdala in dogs, and then they did it in apes, and then they did it in people who had neurological tendencies and uncontrolled rage.
Yes.
And they found that they could eliminate the rage behaviors, and they actually outfitted some people with little buttons that they could press at will, and they could physically, without doing any kind of mental exercises, click their amygdalas and other. There's
all
a whole
right,
series
those,
of
for those of us. Okay, for those of us who don't want electric probes slid in.
Yes, it could be quite inconvenient turning over in bed at night, couldn't it?
Yes.
Or dragging around a long extension cord.
Yes.
You know,
now you're going to suggest, I'm sure, there is a mental process. To bring this on without invasive surgery. At least I hope you're going to.
there's many. Now, this is another thing that was spent many years at the lab. Now, we knew from the scientific data what our goal was. The goal was to experience the positive emotions, the elimination of the negative emotions and traumas.
Right.
We wanted to develop more advanced frontal lobes ability.
Yes.
But we didn't want the long extension cord.
Right.
So over many years of trial and error, many different exercises were designed to allow the ordinary person to click their amygdala forward while they're waiting in line at the supermarket.
Okay, how do you do it?
Okay. There's many ways to do it. Okay? And I'm going to start you out with a very simple way.
Good.
Okay? And, you know, if people are skeptical that they can, that this would have results, think about this.
Hey, try it at home.
Try it at home.
Okay.
You know, and it might be something that your audience right now could try.
All right.
They can call you up and say, I did this. And
all right. Fine. Well, let's have it.
Okay. You know where your amygdala is now, right?
Right.
We've located that.
Right.
What we're going to use is a process known as imaging. Very simple. By imaging a feather. Okay?
A feather?
A feather.
Okay.
Simple feather.
All right.
Now, by imaging this feather, we've instantaneously turned on our frontal lobes. Because the only place you can imagine, create an abstract thought is in your frontal lobes.
All right. So, in other words, that puts the frontal lobe section of the brain to work to image that feather.
Absolutely. Now, we've got to be very careful here.
Why?
What we've got to do is make sure that we now stimulate the front part of our amygdala so that the energy chemical flow is into this advanced part of our brain. And we're going to take that feather and we're going to tickle the front part of our right amygdala. And we're going to tickle the front part of our left amygdala. Okay. Now, if you stimulate mentally the front part of the amygdala, then you're clicking the switch forward into creative, cooperative, imaginative, intuitive, logical behaviors.
You're doing with existing pathways what otherwise would have to be done with surgery.
Yes, absolutely. And
all right,
just the mere fact that you're imaging, you are physically causing electrical chemical activity to occur in your brain.
All right, Neil, I image, we all every day image all kinds of things. It's part of the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
We image things we wish would be. We fantasize. That's imaging. We draw mental pictures about all kinds of things. So many of us are using the frontal lobe portions of our brain on a daily basis.
Yes. I would beg to differ with you on one point, however.
Well, you have been very specific with imaging a feather and then tickling this very specific location right and left.
Yes. Many times what people do when they image is they click their amygdala. Now, the amygdala is like a rheostat. It's just not got one position on and one position off.
Uh-huh.
There is a infinite number of positions.
So you got to tickle the hell out of it.
Well, no.
No.
What I'm saying is, and it's like your thermostat on your wall. You can set it at 60 degrees,
right.
61, 62,
right.
70, all right?
Right.
Now, let's say if we've got it down at 55, we're not sending any heat into our living room.
Gotcha.
Okay? The heat is staying down in the basement.
Right.
Okay? Now, if we crank it up to 55, well, we're sending a little bit of heat into the living room, right? Okay? Same way with our amygdala. If we have it clicked, we can have it clicked a little bit forward, and we can be doing a little bit of imaging in our brain, okay?
Sure.
Or we can have it clicked backwards, in which we image, and still most of the energy is not getting anywhere past our mammal brain. It's just stuck mostly in our reptile brain.
Well, if imaging the feather and tickling the amygdala right and left,
yeah,
begins to turn the heat up.
Yeah.
I'm staying with your analogies.
Okay.
Then why can't we just tickle the hell out of it and turn the heat way up? Or can we?
You can.
You can.
And what I would suggest to you is that cultural conditioning, social conditioning prevents us from doing this.
So then does it require or is it enhanced by some sort of concentration meditation exercise that produces an altered state allowing us to really turn up the temperature?
Can you phrase that question a little differently?
Well, in other words, trying to do this while at the supermarket with all the buzz and hum going on around you,
mm-hmm,
is going to be at best a somewhat difficult thing to do. Doing it in a quiet environment where you are contemplative and you are doing nothing other than focusing on this project would seem to me you'd have a better chance of...
Yes, absolutely, and probably people at home this evening. And I hesitate to suggest that they turn off the radio, but they may want to do it for 30 seconds. And in the complete quiet where they can concentrate on this, close their eyes.
Don't listen to them, people.
No,
that's all right.
And what people report is if they cut down the external stimulus and do this exercise, suddenly they feel a warmth in the front part of their brain.
Okay.
They feel they may sense some lights. They may actually hear very subtle sounds. They may see little sparks. It runs a full gamut. Some people,
really?
First times they do this, don't notice anything. One of the things that was so great about the Brain Lab is that it was located 40 miles in the wilderness. So people would go up to the Brain Lab, and they'd be away from their job, and they'd
sure.
be away from the traffic and the
sure.
pollution, and they would do this, and the results would be spectacular. In the city, it's a little harder because you have a lot of distractions, and your environment is keeping you clicked into self-defense, counterattack. You know, you get in your car and you think, is somebody going to have road rage? You walk into the 7-Eleven and you
Absolutely.
Wonder, is this nut? So your environment is keeping you clicked into your reptile brain. And it's no wonder that you don't experience telepathy or precognition.
All right.
You're too busy with your armor.
All right, let us assume that a lot of people at home are able to take this first step.
Okay.
How long a road is it from the first step and the first feelings that you generate by doing this mental exercise
mm-hmm.
to possible abilities like precognition, like telepathy, like even telekinesis, the ability to move objects with your mind? How much of a journey is it from the very beginning tickle to the development of those sorts of abilities?
It depends on two things. Now, time, we've noticed you talked about the very beginning of your show, popping your frontal lobes.
Yes.
And this is the name that we give to this overwhelming flood of energy. I mean, think of the happiest day of your life, okay, and multiply that times 1,000.
I've got you.
Okay? One day, you will click your amygdala forward, and you will the floodgates to your frontal lobes will open. And, I mean, this is the historical experience known in some circles as nirvana,
yep.
Samadhi, born again. It's related to these historical types of things.
All right, I've got to lay something on you here and at least get your reaction to
okay.
it. I have interviewed many people who believe many things.
Sure.
About a week ago, I interviewed a guest who suggested that indeed there is a physical barrier in the brain, that we use about 10% or less of our brain, and that that barrier was there for a very specific reason, put there by those who created, or if you will, engineered us. In other words, he did not believe fully in the process of evolution as we think we understand it. He suggests that there is a great missing link. And, of course, there is a missing link with regard to our evolutionary process, and that something interceded at the moment, at that particular moment that we cannot yet discern, and intentionally put that barrier there so that we might not develop further. Would you reject that kind of thinking?
I wouldn't reject it entirely, but we know what the barrier is. The barrier is repressed trauma memories, and they're located in the hippocampus. When you are a child growing up and you start, you're dancing at the dinner table and mom says, sit down and finish your peas.
I remember that.
Suddenly, your forward motion into your frontal lobes, fun circuits, cut off.
Crushed.
Your mother took your amygdala and clicked it backwards.
Oh, you've got it, Neil. For me, it was lima beans. Have you ever considered the foul consistency of a lima bean? They're horrible. I used to have to take lima beans and eat them like, you know, I couldn't have dessert, see, unless I ate them. So
yeah.
I had to take them like pills. I would swallow them whole with a glass of milk to get to my dessert.
Well, you know, too, if your mother said that you could never have lima beans, you'd probably want them every day for supper.
Not a chance, Neil. Not a chance. To this very day, they are a foul vegetable from hell that I want nothing to do with. Even the thought, I can do some frontal lobe work here right now, and I can think of a lima bean. I can taste its lousy consistency and its foul taste, and I can image all that right now. And I'm sure it's blowing me back to reptilian times.
You're clicking backwards.
I know. You started it. That is a prime example. It's a good example.
Yeah. But anyway, that's what keeps us from clicking forward. We learn. We are conditioned to click backwards, and we learn that if we click forwards and dance at the dinner table, and if we click forwards and start singing in line at the supermarket,
yeah.
we're going to get our behind whipped.
They're going to take us away to a quiet spot.
That's right. And so as we grow up, and from all these traumas being hammered into us, our switch kind of gets turned back and back, and eventually we completely forget how to click that switch forward.
Okay. So we have been environmentally turned back.
Culturally conditioned.
Culturally conditioned.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's a cosmic joke. It's the great cosmic joke. The Zen people say enlightenment is passing through the gate where there is no gate. You know, when you discover that you can indeed click forward into your frontal lobes and there's nothing stopping you from doing it, it's like dropping the lead weights that you've been carrying around your shoulders for your whole life. And this is what the big, you know, when you get in an airplane and your ears clog up, you know.
Oh, I know
and,
about that.
And all of a sudden they pop.
Yep.
And everything, you can hear. When you pop
I know the feeling, Neil.
Okay, we're talking about the frontal lobes pop. Imagine what that feels like.
Yeah. Oh, it must be incredible. All right, Neil Slade, hang on. We're going to take calls when we come back. If you've been with us for a while, then I do presume you're following this, and it absolutely makes sense. Think about that frontal lobe, folks.
Now again, here's Art.
Once again, here I am. My guest is Neil Slade, and this is really, really fascinating stuff. We're actually teaching you a way you can switch your brain into a higher gear, in effect, and enter the areas where you can do things that, I don't know, other people claim they have natural abilities for, psychic abilities, healing, telepathy, telekinesis, which I imagine would be out at the outside of a fully developed ability. And we're going to ask Neil some questions here shortly. Neil, welcome back.
Thank you.
Are you ready to take some questions?
Sure.
All right, then let us do that. First time caller line, you're on the air with Neil Slade. Good morning.
Hi, Art.
Hi.
The thing that I wanted to call in and say was his assertion that you can't use psychic abilities for evil or for, you know, reptile brain things.
Yes.
Don't think it's true because I'm a reformed criminal. I used to break into houses. I used to steal things, anything that wasn't nailed down. I used to sell drugs. I would use these things to keep myself from getting caught. I mean, you know, I would know when the police car was four blocks away and I'd know to get out of the house.
Huh.
I'd know when the guy buying drugs from me wasn't, you know, really somebody was buying drugs. I'd know it was an undercover cop. I'd say, I don't think I'll sell to you. You know, don't know what you're talking about. And it's, I mean, in my current job, I use it to drive away annoying customers. You know, that's not exactly a good act.
Well, are you sure that you were able to do that, or were you using a lower form of intuition?
Well, I can't, you know, really define the difference between intuition and psychic ability.
I hear you. Yeah, I hear you. All right. Well, there you are, Neil. Somebody claiming he used it for negative purpose. How do you answer that?
Well, it sounds as like you said you're reformed.
I am now,
Yeah, it sounds as like you weren't able to continue perpetually. And perhaps some of these things that you were saying, it's like you knew when the police were four blocks away. Some of these things could have been just very normal types of, very common brain functioning. It was like maybe you were imagining.
Well, subliminally hearing the.
Yeah. Right, I understand what you're saying.
From wherever,
but,
yeah.
But it also sounds like at the same time there was this little voice all along that was saying, well, you just can't go on forever and do this kind of thing. And I think this realization that what you were doing was not only not good for society as a whole and not good for you and your future, I think this kind of went hand in hand, and that's what I was referring to earlier when I was saying, when you use the higher functions of the brain to do things that ultimately cause yourself and society damage, it's like putting your finger in a hot flame. You just can't do it. And if you do it, you can only do it for so long, and then you've got to pull your finger out. Yeah. So
what I do for a living now is I deal cards in a casino.
Uh-huh.
And
that's a productive, I think.
Well,
know.
Now wait a minute.
I don't think I'm doing too much good for society.
Yeah, let's examine that. He deals cards in a casino. Now he's working for the casino.
Uh-huh.
It is the exact opposite situation of the one you presented with us to us earlier. In other words, to look good in his job. To look good to the boss, to look good, period, he's got to win.
I'm what's called a house dealer.
Sure.
Yeah,
you don't win at my table.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, you're
there are. Let me tell you something, Neil. There are. I know something about Las Vegas, and there are certain dealers. And you pointed out earlier that if somebody's winning, they will take certain steps. And trust me, one of those steps is they will change the dealers. They'll take somebody like this fellow and substitute him for whoever was at that table, because, believe me, they're gone. Is that correct, caller?
Oh, yeah.
I know about the casino industry, and there are people like this caller who win for the house, not by cheating, just because it's what they do. Now, this kind of backs up what you're talking about, Neil, but it kind of erodes one aspect of what you've been talking about, and that is that it cannot be used for a less than fully moral, ethical purpose.
Well, I think gambling entertainment is something that society benefits from to some degree.
And we're not arguing the benefits or not of gambling.
So if the casinos lose money, well, they're going to go out of business, and then their function will be non-existent.
Yes,
so,
I know. But when you break it down to the level of this caller, though, he's sitting there, and we're talking about him versus the people he's dealing to. And the immediate effect is the person loses, and he wins, and it's a negative effect on them. So he is using this power in a way that would be less than fully ethical.
Yeah, I don't necessarily buy that he's using a higher brain function to cause the other person to lose. If you see it that way, well, you know, okay.
All right, caller, thank you. I think you made a very good point. I'm buying off on about 80% of what you're saying, Neil, and the only place that I sort of have a problem is that I think it is a power. I think it's as real as can be, but I do believe that it can be used for purposes that are not as high and moral and ethical as you would hope.
Okay. Well, we can agree to disagree.
Yep. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Neil Slade. Hello.
Hello, Art. Hello, Mr. Slade.
How are you?
I have a comment and a question, and I'm the one that was in Reno, Art, that saw that.
Yeah, I'm going to read that report here in a moment. Thank you for reminding me.
Oh, sure. Okay. I tapped into what you guys were discussing years ago, eons ago on 36, and have you guys done any research on it? I found that it amplifies just through the realization that it exists, rather than attributing déjà vu and or coincidence. If you attribute that to what it actually is, which is precognitive skills and each time you accept the realism of it, it accelerates and amplifies the ability. Have you guys researched that from that direction at all?
The subject of déjà vu, how does that fit in?
Well,
déjà vu is the feeling that you have been somewhere, this place before, even though you never have been.
I think what this woman is saying is that once you see it work, then it's becomes easier to access, and that is these are self reinforcing skills. Am I correct?
The lady is not there.
Oh,
now,
she's gone.
She's gone. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, the frontal lobe skills are cumulative. Okay. At the beginning, when you first start clicking your amygdala forward and you start accessing more and more of your frontal lobe's abilities, you get some instant gratifications. And this is sort of built into your brain to encourage you to further evolve and
sure.
these cooperative circuits.
Sure. This is a good thing. Proceed.
Yes, that's right. You get instant reward. Keep going, okay?
Gotcha.
What we suggest, and one of the exercises in that I suggest in the book, is that you begin a self-diagnosis graph, okay?
and you begin to chart. You just get some graph paper, and you can chart incidences of that you feel of intuition. You can chart increases in the daily pleasurable sensations that you feel. You can chart all kinds of your frontal lobes types of skills, and you might want to start this graph a week before you start doing any of the brain exercises, so you get a baseline.
All right, here's one that you probably cannot answer.
Okay.
You're talking about the development of moving into your frontal lobe area and then developing these skills. There appear to be a group of people who, let me again go to tomorrow night's guest, Danyon Brinkley. Fascinating case. Here's a guy who was standing at home one night talking on the telephone years ago and was struck by lightning. Now, when I say struck by lightning, I mean really struck by lightning. The metal nails in his shoes were welded to the floor, the nails in the floor.
Mm-hmm.
He was on fire, literally caught on fire. He clinically died. And when he came out of it, he had a super development of all of the kinds of skills we're talking about, perhaps short of telekinesis, and I haven't even talked to him about that one. But he had skills beyond belief, some of which he retains today, but they slowly began to fade as time went on after that incident.
Mm-hmm.
So that you've got somebody like Danyon who acquired these skills through tragedy, and you've got other people who appear to be naturals, these natural psychic people that we talk about. And then you've got apparently a third group that you suggest can be all of us who can train ourselves into this.
Mm-hmm.
Is that about right?
It sounds like everything you've said is certainly possible, and it sounds like it has all happened. It sounds like what he experienced was a sudden rewiring of his nervous system.
You bet.
Which was accidental in nature.
Correct.
And since he wasn't aware of how it happened, it was something he eventually reverted back to what we consider normal consciousness. That probably could, explain why these sort of things faded. His circuitry just went back to the way it was. You have other people who seem to have I got some email today from a lady, and she said, well, how come some people can look at a book and memorize the whole book just by turning the pages, photographic memory, and some people can't? Well, it's like, well, why are some people 6 feet tall and some people are, 3.5 feet tall?
Right.
It's just, we all have a given sort of, some of us get some abilities, and some of us get other abilities. There's no really rhyme or reason for any of that. You just get what you get. On the other hand, everyone can always, you don't have to be born a piano player. You can sit down and practice 10 minutes a day and learn how to play the piano. And just about everyone can do that. So in the same way, we can all develop these advanced, cooperative, creative, intelligent, paranormal skills if we practice them. We may not be born with exceptional amounts. We may not get struck by lightning, but it looks like the research shows that we can develop these to useful levels.
Fascinating. All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Neil Slade. Hello.
Hi, I'm Neil.
Hi.
This is Steve Millett.
Steve, where are you?
I'm in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. I was wondering, Neil, what your take was again on deja vu?
Deja vu.
Deja vu, yes.
The feeling that you've been, that you've already experienced.
Right.
Done this, been there, even though you haven't.
I have a comment on it, but I was wondering what your take was on it, Neil.
You want to hear my take first?
Yeah.
Our brains are amazing computers. We have something between 10 billion and 100 billion neurons in our brain, and then we've got 10 times as many supporting cells underneath. So it's more complicated than any computer you could imagine.
Okay.
And the processing ability of the human brain is incredible. Now, probably what happens is, in the case of deja vu, is you computed the probabilities of an event before coming to that event.
Mm-hmm.
You may have thought...
Precognition?
Precognition, right. And
oh,
when you
right.
arrive...
That, that makes sense.
And when you arrive at that event, you say, oh, I've already been here.
Okay.
Because you've already computed that scenario in your brain. And so it all feels very familiar.
Excellent, Neil. Excellent. All right. Does that answer your question, caller?
Well, no, my... No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I thought it was excellent myself. But
my take on that is something along the lines of your left hemisphere and your right hemisphere talk to each other
mm-hmm.
through those electrical neurons that you were talking about.
Uh-huh.
And occasionally, like a car, you might misfire a spark. So the left hand, say you're coming up on a town you know you've never been in. And as you go through the town, the right-hand part of your brain sees something and shoots it over to the left-hand side of the brain, but it misfires right then.
Hmm.
And so on the next time that it shoots across the neurons, the left side gets the information. And it says, it got the information a nanosecond late that time. So it's like,
I
had this thought before.
Yep.
Now I'm having it again.
All right, caller. I appreciate that, but I consider Neil's explanation to be far more elegant and consistent with what he's been saying all evening long. I appreciate your call. Listen, we've got a break here at the bottom of the hour. Neil, hang tight. We'll be right back. Neil Slate is my guest. I'm Art Bell. And this is Coast to Coast AM.
This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye. Now again, here's Art.
Once again, here I am. Neil Slade is my guest. Fascinating stuff. The brain in general, it is a fascinating topic, and I'm going to underscore a lot of what he's just told you with some hard science in a moment. I want to cover this. Art, Phil, one of your board operators at 780 KOH in Reno, at 5:57 p.m. this evening, a slow-moving red light was seen by many of our listeners in the sky south of Reno. Sean, the evening board op, Brad, the afternoon board op, Jim Fannin, one of our reporters, and myself, the overnight board operator, also saw it. It was incredibly bright and flashing at irregular intervals. This light was also seen by the air traffic controllers at the Reno Tahoe International Airport Tower, but they have no clue what it was. An airport spokesman told me that it did not, in caps, not show up on their radar. Strange, to be sure. So that is a precise report from my affiliate in Reno. I presume many of you have seen it. I'm being flooded with reports. Now, back to Neil Slade. I've got in front of me something from the Electronic Telegraph, issue number 906, issued Sunday, 16 November 97. An article entitled, Science Proves Mind's Power Over Matter, and I mentioned Princeton, so here we go. Startling evidence that the human mind can exert paranormal control over objects has been uncovered by researchers whose findings have confounded even hardened skeptics. Experiments conducted by a team at Princeton University are now being hailed as the most convincing demonstration yet of so-called psychokinesis, the supposed ability of thought to affect inanimate objects. Until now, most claims for the existence of PK have rested largely on anecdotal evidence. Poltergeist, wrecking homes, demonstrations by stage performers like Uri Geller, who claim to bend forks and spoons by thought alone. Since the early 80s, Professor Robert John, J-A-H-N, and colleagues of the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Project have been perfecting a series of tightly controlled laboratory tests of PK to discover once and for all whether the phenomena exists or not. The experiments focus on electronic random number generators, bingo, which produce an utterly unpredictable sequence of ones and zeros. Subjects are asked to concentrate on a display showing the output of these generators and to try to change the numbers it produces. Left to themselves, the devices will produce equal numbers of ones and zeros in the long run. If PK exists, however, it should reveal itself in a bias away from chance expectations as subjects will the output toward one way or the other. Now, after 12 years of experiments involving more than 100 subjects in thousands of trials, Professor John and his team have uncovered astonishing evidence that the electronic devices can be controlled by thought. The human subjects, listen now carefully, proved capable of altering the output of the devices so much that the chances of getting such a bias by fluke alone is calculated to be less than 1 in 1,000 billion. Let me repeat that. The chances of getting such a bias by fluke alone calculated to be less than 1 in 1,000 billion. Neil, what do you think?
It doesn't seem that far-fetched to me at all. It seems actually quite likely, because what you're talking about in the computer program is electrical impulses.
Of course.
Now, our brains work the same way. Actually, the computer is a simplified model of the way our brain works.
Neural pathways, yes.
That's right. Now, our brains are constantly radiating electromagnetic energy. In
Absolutely.
Fact, I believe this is how an MRI, pardon me,
yes.
it picks up, it sends magnetic, electromagnetical field particles. I'm not exactly sure how it works, but what it's doing is reflecting the amount of electrical activity that occurs in the brain. Any type of electrical device radiates energy, which can be picked up by magnets and measured. And it would seem to me that a computer can be manipulated by another object that is generating a stronger type of electromagnetic field. They're probably working on that same type of frequency.
All right. Well, that's right. I've got you. All right. Let's go back to the phones. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Neil Slade. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. This is Steve in Bellingham, Washington. Was listening to you on KGMI?
Yes, sir.
Yes. I only have a few problems here. One, I don't think that Neil quite answered your question about the God spot in the brain. He had a lot of things to say about that, around it, but he never did quite come out and say what it does.
Well, that's because nobody quite knows yet, to be fair to Neil. Even the researchers have no idea yet what this is all about. They know that when religious thoughts are thought, this particular area can be demonstrated to be active. Now, you can look at this in two ways. One, that this has always been in our brains, and that we are naturally religious people, spiritual people, and that's because it's in our brains. And the other would be that it is a conditioned thing that we are brought up. We go to Sunday school, we're taught about God and the Bible and or Buddha or whatever, and that part of the brain is developed as a result. Now, they don't know the answer to that yet, so I don't expect that Neil has an answer, but if you do, Neil, fire away.
Subjectively, people say when certain areas of their brain are stimulated, they feel as though they are witnessing God consciousness, and this is what they tell us. And I was just reading today about ancient Taoist meditations that instructed the practitioner to concentrate on the pineal portion, the pineal gland, and that by doing so, one would attain this highest communication with the Godhead or with cosmic consciousness. So that's just been the feedback from people, you know, what they said that they have experienced as to whether or not we can validate the existence of God. You might be suggesting that we can validate the existence of a non-physical entity in a physical universe, which is impossible. So it's going to be subjective.
All right, back to my phone line. All right, I've got you. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Neil Slade. Hello.
Hey, Art, how you doing?
All right.
You know, on the deja vu, that one caller from Massachusetts said that his explanation is one generally accepted by most neurologists, Art.
That may well be. But if you buy the fact that we have some precognitive abilities, then the explanation that Neil Slade gave is absolutely elegant. In other words, we have, in effect, seen this in either a conscious or a slightly subconscious way, and so when, in fact, we do see it, we recognize it vaguely as something we are familiar with, the feeling of deja vu.
Well, it seems as though scientists will always come up with an explanation that fits their agenda, and it may or may not be correct, and I certainly don't dismiss that explanation, but I think there's always room for, well, yeah, but maybe this is why it works too. So, you know, I'm not necessarily in disagreement with that other fellow's explanation. I think there's many ways to interpret especially in neurological phenomenon, and so I offered my explanation. And if you like it, okay, and if you like the other guys, well, that's okay too.
Yeah. In other words, scientists, sir, for a long time have poo-pooed the whole idea of precognition, PSI-type abilities, certainly telekinesis, and yet I just read you an article indicating at Princeton they have proven these abilities beyond any shadow of a doubt. Now, what do your same scientists say about that?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know what their opinions on that are. I agree that there are precognitive abilities in humans. I've experienced them myself.
Well, in that case, is it a very large stretch to imagine that what we call deja vu is simply a lighter form of precognition?
No, I don't think it's a stretch. I'm just saying that what the caller from Massachusetts said is
correct. Correct, yeah. As far as conventional wisdom is concerned,
yes, the transference of visualizing something or perceiving something to memory in such a
yes.
fast time that it comes out in your memory so quickly that you can't perceive it.
The only caution that I would give you is, the very same scientists that are feeding you that are also saying that telekinesis is simply hogwash.
Can I interject something about this function of telekinesis? Because I gave it some thought last night. Many of these paranormal abilities that we have seem to take place when our normal senses and our normal abilities are not accessible to us. For example, the time when you were watching television, your normal senses, since you were watching television, had no way of telling you here was some clown that was going to bash your car. So when you needed to get information other than through your normal senses, then that sense of precognition, those particular frontal lobe circuits came into play. As far as people using telekinesis, you know, in the time that it takes Uri Geller to bend a spoon with his mind, you or I could bend a dozen with our fingers. And this probably could explain the reason why we don't see so many examples of telekinesis from day to day, because we already have very accessible, very easily used methods of moving objects, and it's almost silly to try to move a chair with our mind when all we have to do is pick it up and and move it with our hands. And the times when we do see examples of telekinesis, it's probably on much more subtle levels, such as you were giving the example of electronic random numbers being changed by thought process and things like that.
Well,
we can't move those electronic numbers with our fingers. There's no really way to get in that machine and do that. So this is where perhaps our mind gets in a place where we can't get into the screen with our fingers.
Well, look at a one-armed bandit like we have in Las Vegas.
Okay.
I would suggest to you that they are random number generators.
Okay.
And that they have a certain percentage of hit. Now, I'm not familiar with the precise electronic setup of a one-armed bandit.
They can calculate.
Or other gambling devices. But
yeah.
Basically, I think there's a random number generator involved.
Yeah.
And legally, there must be. One can project quite simply from affecting a picture on a screen, you can extend to affecting the outcome of a poll.
And I've had actual experience with that particular device that you're talking about. My experience was waking up from a dream in which my dream said that showed me that I was winning money at a slot machine. Now, I live about 50 miles from the nearest legal casino.
Yeah.
That morning I said, well, hey, I'm headed off to Blackhawk. And I went, and I won about $175 in a space of about 10 minutes on a slot machine.
Then you walked away or did you put it back in?
No, I walked away that day. Now, I have gone back on occasion, and I didn't walk away soon enough. But on that particular one, I either had a precognition of that event happening or my brain was telling me.
No, I understand.
This day, you will be able to manipulate that machine and walk away with a little change in your pocket. I think it is possible to do that. I'm personally not very good at that with slot machines.
All right. Listen, Neil, do you have... I've been talking to you for a long time now. Do you have a book or a tape that you would like to plug here?
Sure. I have two books available, but the one I would really suggest to your listeners that they start out with is a book entitled Have Fun. And I took all my 23 years of teaching experience and my 11 years of brain experience and all my college education, and I tried to come up with my own unified field theory for doing things and turning on the frontal lobes.
Okay.
And what I came up with was this simple thought, have fun. And if one can train oneself to have fun, one can keep the frontal lobes turned on and stay clicked out of the negative experience of the reptile brain. And your listeners can simply send me a check or a money order for $10.95, and I'll give you the address if they're out of Colorado.
All right.
Send that $10.95 to Box. Send it to Neil Slade, Box 6799, Denver, Colorado, 80206, and we'll get you started into turning on more and more of your frontal lobes' advanced abilities, and you will truly have more and more fun in your daily job and in your relationships, and you'll start to play around with your paranormal stuff, and it will just start happening to you.
Or barring that, they can also go to my website,
yes.
www.artbell.com, and pop over to your website by scrolling down to Neil Slade's name and clicking on that.
And they will get all the information.
All right, $10.95, Neil Slade, Box 6799, Denver, Colorado, 80206. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
All right, my friend, I thank you for being with us this evening, and we will have you on again. It has been a pleasure.
It's been a great pleasure for me as well, Art. Thank you very much.
Take care. That's Neil Slade. All right, tomorrow night, his condition allowing, we are going to have Danyon Brinkley here. And he will be here in the second hour of the program. Danyon Brinkley, again, though, as you know, he is recovering from a very serious condition, which you'll hear more about tomorrow night. And his health allowing, he will be with us tomorrow evening. I would like to remind you that I have two books. Actually, now I'm sorry to say just one book. We have a new offer, all of The Art of Talk. The Art of Talk is gone, sold out. I warned you that it was about to be sold out. Well, it's sold out. Here's the deal that we've got for you. You can order The Art of Talk, the first book I wrote about talk radio and myself and my life, blah, blah, all the rest of it, on audio. We do have audio versions of it available that I will autograph for you. And or, of course, my new book, The Quickening. We are offering autographed copies of that as well. This will only extend for a very few more days. In other words, it's almost all over, but the shouting. I said I would do this for a very slim period of time near Christmas. That slim period of time is now. The Art of Talk hardback is already sold out as of tonight, but we are offering two things. You can get either one or both, and that is the audio version of The Art of Talk, autographed, I say, and, of course, The Quickening, autographed. But this offer is only going to last a few more days. The number to call is 1-800-864-7991. Write that number down. Better yet, call it right now. It is good 24 hours a day. It's 1-800-864-7991. You know, I'm out here in the desert where they have those little signs, last chance gas for 200 miles or something like that. They used to have them anyway. This is kind of like that. This offer is kind of like that. It is the last time I'm ever going to be autographing. So either take advantage of it now or it's going to be gone. 1-800-864-7991. In some markets, we'll be back with one more hour. We'll cover what has occurred in Reno and take some reports. And I've got several other things for you. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell.
This is Coast to Coast AM from the Kingdom of Nye with Art Bell.
It is, and it continues at this hour. And as I did at the beginning of the program, I would like to make a request for help from my audience. And in due course, I will explain to you why I am doing this. There is apparently a program run by somebody named Ted Gunderson on something called Amerinet, which transmits on Galaxy One, some transponder, I'm not sure which one, on Galaxy One, and is broadcast as well on shortwave. And there was a program yesterday with a guest named Dave, and I'm searching for anybody who has an audio taped recording of this program. You would be doing me a very great favor if you would contact me, and we can make arrangements to get that tape if you happen to have it. I would appreciate an immediate communication from you. And you may do this in a number of ways. You can email me at artbell, A-R-T-B-E-L-L, lowercase, at AOL.com. That's artbell at AOL.com. You may fax me at area code 702-727-8499, 702-727-8499, or if you failing those two possibilities, you can call my network in the morning at area code 541-664-8829. That's area code 541-664-8829, and again, we're searching for an audio tape copy of a program done yesterday on something called the Amerinet network, or whatever it is, broadcast on Galaxy One, a program with Ted Gunderson and somebody named Dave. And so if you happen to have a copy of that or access to it, you would be doing me a large favor by getting it to me in one of the above prescribed ways. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, Art, it's Vince in Chicago.
Hey, Vince.
I heard something interesting on the shortwave radio yesterday, and I don't know if this is kind of what you were interested in, but they were talking about the March 13th Phoenix Lights.
No, that is not it, actually.
But anyway, about the Phoenix Lights, you know, I think that's like the greatest UFO mystery of all time.
Modern time.
Modern time.
Yeah, I think you're correct. It's, of modern time, I would say that is the greatest mystery.
It's really a strange one. You want me to let you know what I heard? They
sure.
said it's the shortwave broadcast. They said it's a military operation called Project Blue Smoke.
How do they know?
I guess some sources in the military are speaking on this, and they said it's got something to do with FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management. And, no, it kind of plays into some of the, you know, if you think about it.
Well, I'm thinking about it, and it doesn't.
Well, did you ever notice how the FEMA, the symbol, has a pyramid on there? On their seal?
What does that have to do with the price of tea?
Like what Richard Hoagland talks about, Phoenix, the
yeah.
pyramid rising out of the ashes, you know,
right.
the Egyptian angle.
Yes.
FEMA has a pyramid as part of their official seal.
Yes.
It's all this, you know, that's why I say the March 13th UFO thing in Phoenix is so strange. It's so bizarre.
It is all of that. But I thank you, Vince. I fail to see the connection to FEMA. I frankly fail to see a great connection to Egypt. I do agree it is the greatest modern UFO mystery of contemporary times. With that statement, I agree, and it kind of went downhill after that, in my opinion. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art. My name is Brian. I'm calling you from Boulder, Colorado.
Hello, Brian.
K-H-O-W, I think it is. I always get the call letters goofed up. You were out here once. Anyway, I have a phone number that Ted Genderson once gave out over the air, if you'd like to have that.
No, I have some phone numbers. What I need is a copy of that program.
Yeah, I didn't tape. I, in fact, I used to listen to him on a little right-wing radio station that got burned out up in...
I want to verify something that was said on it before I proceed.
Yeah, well, they say some pretty wild things on there.
Words have meaning.
They certainly do. Words really have meaning, and... I like what you said earlier. You said something about politics don't always affect what we do. Ultimately, I think that's true, and politics are getting out of it. And
well, what I said was that a hell of a lot of what's going on back in Washington right now is simply irrelevant to our lives. You know, a lot of what they're arguing about and doing,
mm-hmm.
meaningless to
yeah.
us. Meaningless. On the other hand, when a story, thank you very much, like the one that we covered in the first hour with Chris Ruddy comes along, demands attention. The funny part of it is that if you heard that first hour, I don't think there would be much attention at all except for the way they have reacted. X-rays destroyed, X-rays missing, Lieutenant Colonel talks, Lieutenant Colonel gets put under virtual house arrest. Another lieutenant colonel gets so angry at what has happened that he joins the first lieutenant colonel in telling this story. You know, that is a potential, or to me it's an indication of the kind of stonewalling that is to hide something. Something very potentially serious. Potentially even a capital crime. Now, it may not be that, but their reaction is certainly very, very suspicious, isn't it? First-time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Alex. This is Janina in Chicago.
Hi there.
Hi. I have a question or comment about Neil's theory, and I also had a question for you regarding Father Malachi Martin.
Hi.
I want to sort of extend what people were saying about thinking that these psychic abilities really still can be used for evil. And by the way, I'm you know, I'm not any kind of right-wing person, but anyway, what about those people who purport to practice black magic in the context of the victim, as it were, not being aware that anything is being done, so that the power of suggestion isn't coming into play there?
No, I'm with you. I disagree with Neil in that area, and I think that these things are powers that may be developed and then used for good or bad.
Well, and then, and now this comment kind of goes along with my next question. If you're going to accept the possibility of spiritual evolution through reincarnation, it would seem that one of the things that we are meant to do is learn sort of right action and discrimination, and a lot of that is through mistakes. It would seem that it would be that would apply to the metaphysical as well as the physical level. So, you know, if you're saying, you see what I'm saying?
Right.
So that if you're saying that none of this could happen unless you're doing good, that sort of mixes the whole karma and spiritual evolution angle as a learning process.
I don't reject it. Sure.
My other question, I heard Malachi Martin for the first time when he was on your show this week.
Yes.
I was wondering if you ever had a chance to ask him. He said, of course, that he does not believe in reincarnation. And did you ever get a chance to ask him whether he is taking that position solely because that is the current position of the Catholic Church, or whether, you know, he sort of feels that prayer is sort of a revelatory experience for him, and that's kind of direct information that he's gotten?
Well, I can't speak for him, but I'm sure that he would say that he believes that as an article of faith, his faith.
Uh-huh. But I mean, I was just wondering if you have ever asked him a question like that.
Sure. I have asked him any number of times, thank you, whether he disagrees with something or another with regard to church doctrine, and the answer in many cases has been yes. I have never tested his personal belief with regard to reincarnation against the church position. But, of course, there will be yet another interview, without a doubt, with Malachi Martin, and I would be glad to do that for you. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art. How you doing?
Okay.
Yeah, Art, I just want to call and officially apologize the other night to you and Peter Davenport for saying what I did about him not possibly being a governmental, Black Project operative.
Disinformation agent.
Yeah. I want to apologize. I found out I couldn't use the 9-cent line MCI long-distance dialing line, and that's why I was getting the busy signal all
week. Well, wouldn't you think that it was kind of a leap from having a problem with your phone to accusing him of being a disinformation agent because you couldn't get through?
It was a pure frustration of the event of seeing the UFOs. And then not being able to inform anyone, even from MUFON.
All right. Well, then, in behalf of Peter Davenport, I accept the apology. I thought it was atrocious of you at the time to suggest, simply because you couldn't, because you were getting a busy signal, that he was a disinformation agent. That is a leap beyond even what I can contemplate into the blackness of illogic. East of the Rockies, you're on the air.
Yes, Art, this is Kim in Austin, Texas, listening on KJFK FM.
Yes, sir.
I think your guest tonight raised some really important questions about the inherent but usually latent abilities of the human brain.
I quite agree.
During the early 80s, I was living in Austin, in Dallas, Texas, and at that time, This drug called MDMA was widely distributed, I think starting in Dallas back at that time, and at that time it was legal. And I can tell you, I am convinced that the human mind has really different abilities than I think that can be accessed through meditation.
What was MDMA?
MDMA, ecstasy. If you remember back in the early 80s.
I recall now, yes.
Ecstasy,
yes. The street term. But you know what? I never really quite understood what it was.
You can't explain it.
Of course.
You cannot explain the feeling. When he was talking, or your guest was talking earlier tonight about the drive to do things for the whole group instead of just for yourself.
Yes.
That is the exact feeling that particular substance induced in people. I mean, a wide variety of people could get together, and they would all have that same feeling of closeness, of wanting to relate with the other people. It was, you didn't even feel, you know, drunk, high, anything like that. It was just this major feeling of connecting with other people. And so all I'm saying is I really think that non-governmental groups or doctors or research groups or whatever should be allowed to study all the different avenues of processes or ways that people in society can move more towards that kind of group consciousness, that frame of mind where people feel connected to each other and want to help each other. And I'm telling you, I mean, it is absolutely real. It is absolutely real.
Well, I don't rule that out either. And what he's talking about is a chemical path to achieve what Neil Slade was talking about doing mentally. What originally Neil Slade talked about doing with electrical probes and stimulation. This caller talks about the pharmacology angle, and I don't rule that out either. It just seems to me that if you're going to experiment, the safest, clearest beginning that you could make would be the one described by Neil Slade, and I absolutely don't rule that out. The only problem I had with his entire presentation was his apparent insistence that it could not be used, this power once acquired, for less than fully ethical or moral reasons. I have great doubts about that. It may well be that an ethical, moral person could not imagine that. But like any power, I think it could be wielded in many directions. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes, hello, Art. Rich in San Jose.
Yes, Rich.
How are you, sir?
Fine.
Good. I just wanted to let you know that I still haven't got my fidgets yet. I think he punked out on us.
Well, let me tell you what he claims. He claims all the fidgets are going out, that he got way behind, got buried, and has sent some out, not all, but they all will eventually go out. Now, I'll tell you this. Mr. Fidget will not see the light of day on my program until I start getting phone calls from people saying, gee, I got my fidget.
And I'll be the first one to call you. I was the first one to put the order in.
Okay, I'll look for your call, and the moment I hear from you and people like you that fidgets are arriving, then Mr. Fidget and I will again communicate.
Right. Thank you, Art.
Thank you, sir. Take care. East of the Rockies, you are on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art. This is Tom in Rock Island.
Yes, sir.
Illinois.
Right.
WOC.
Right.
I've asked you a few times about psychic healing.
Yes.
And I don't know if you had seen them or not.
I'm sure I did.
Okay, but what I want to do is just give a couple examples that people can test themselves on. And one of them, I'd like to give an analogy here that we've all experienced when we were children and stuff in school, is where we felt someone was staring at us. We turned around and we found that they were. Okay, and this is the concentration of energy.
That's a good point.
Okay, and it's backed by the desire, or let's say, for example, somebody was angry at someone. So that proves two things. One, yes, there is something, and two, yes, it can be used negatively.
I think that you have proven your point exquisitely well. Thank you. The man is exactly right. How many times in your life have you thought you were alone and yet had an intense, strong feeling that somebody was observing you, watching you? And you turn around, and sure enough, there they are. Now, what is that? Intuition? A lighter form of precognition? Exactly what Neil Slade was talking about. Its uses, I think, are many. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Here is a, actually a fax from Lee. Thank you, Lee. Howdy, Art. I tried it. I tickled that area, as per your guest's instructions, and almost immediately began to laugh uncontrollably. Belly laughs, guffaws, it could be heard throughout the house. Even now, almost 45 minutes later, I still feel strangely elevated. There definitely is something going on here. Well, the basis of Anil Slade's presentation tonight I found rather compelling. And I think that a great deal of what he said has a basis in truth. It simply makes sense if you got a chance to hear most of it. It simply makes sense. The only argument, as I now endlessly repeat, that I have with it is its ultimate use. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Yeah, I'm looking for Art.
Well, you found him.
Oh,
I'm the only one. We don't screen call. See, we just.
Yeah, I knew that, but I just hear a commercial.
Well, that's because you're listening to your radio.
Well, Art, that was an interesting show tonight.
Yes.
I have a related experience to what he talked about, and that is that for about 20 years, off and on, I've loved to play blackjack. And it's not a machine, you know, it's people. And I've found that when I'm in the right mood, I've had incredible streaks of winning hands, you know, 20, 30 at a time.
Yep.
And I've always wondered, how did I do that, you know, and tried to recreate that. And I've been able to do it sometimes. You know, I actually have some control over it. And it's got a lot to do with being in a good mood and not being too surprised when you get 421s in a row and, you know, things like that. Most of the other people at the table, of course, are you know, just unbelievable. You know, they can't believe it. The dealer, I've had dealers go, it's another 21, you know. And create a ruckus, actually. That was just one thing. And I think that, you know, if you contact that part of your brain or you're using that part of your brain, I think you actually change reality because those cards aren't a machine.
Well, I agree with you. And I'm almost hesitant to talk about this, but, you know, I'm in Nevada where we have gaming. It's
sure.
Legal here. And there are times when I walk by machines and something inside me tells me, go play.
Sure.
Now, I hardly ever, you know, I'm the kind of guy who, I don't believe in gambling. I don't believe in gambling. But everybody here just about will occasionally drop a quarter in a machine. And I am so far ahead in the years that I've lived in Nevada by doing that, by only going to a machine when I feel like it. When I feel I'm drawn to it, that something's going to happen. And more times than not, it does. Now, I don't want to encourage anybody out there into gambling.
Well,
I'm just telling you that what you think you can do, I believe that you are correct. I believe Neil Slade is correct. The problem, of course, is that people then think they can continue to do this. And I don't do it except when I feel it. If you push it and sit there at the table trying to push it, then they're going to win because that's how they build big casinos.
Well, you're absolutely right, because as well as I can lose or win 20 hands in a row, I can also lose 20 hands, me particular.
Exactly.
The woman next to me, the grandmother next to me, she can go, you know, win one, lose one. I go in streaks because of this.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm tuned into it, and I have to realize when I'm tuned out of it. Because I can, you know, you can use it. It can be used against you.
Well, that's the hard part. I appreciate the call, sir. Thank you. That verifies, in a way, what Neil Slade was saying. The hard part is not doing it when it's not there, and that's where almost everybody fails, and that's how they build these great big casinos. Right? First time caller on the line. You're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. It's the first time I called, so.
Right. Well, all right, then let us go through the basics. Yes,
okay.
We're on the air. Turn your radio off, please.
Okay.
We'll wait while you do that.
All right, hang on.
Hanging. You should have the radio near your phone because it will confuse you horrendously hearing yourself 6 seconds later.
Okay.
Okay, now you can function normally.
Okay.
What's on your mind?
I just found on the internet, I'm listening to it through the internet, and I just found it, and I was kind of interested in it because...
Found what?
The Art Bell Show.
Oh. Where are you?
I'm in California.
California. All right. Well, that's right. We're on the internet.
Okay. Are you not live right now on the internet?
Well, I would presume we are. Yes.
Okay. This is Art Bell now?
I'm the only one here. Yeah, it's me.
Okay. Well, then I guess we're live.
All right. Now we've got all that established. What can I do for you, sir?
Sorry about that. Well, anyways, I was listening to the show.
Yes.
And what I was, like, noticing is that there's a thought of mine that about pieces missing in the whole concept that you were talking about on making things like occur with your thoughts and stuff. And that is the doubts that we have programmed in our minds throughout our entire lives are the things that kind of creep in.
Oh, yeah, that's really
what we're working on.
Okay, thank you. That's exactly what Neil Slade was talking about, that we are conditioned with the noise and the demands of modern society, work, marriages, families, things that go wrong, pipes to fix, the everyday things of life, that we rarely move into a mode where we can begin to develop these things. So you are exactly right. A wild card line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art. I'm calling on KSTP here in Minnesota. This is Emo.
Yes, sir.
And I'm just going to say something here real quick. I remember like a couple of years ago, you had this one guy on there that you were interviewing who said that he lived with Bigfoots, how they're interdimensional, how he's seen one doing CPR before and cameras don't work on them because radioactive backup, and it was more of like a real fun show to listen to.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering, have you ever heard from him, or how's he doing?
Living with the Bigfoots.
I imagine that, but I was just thinking about that, and that was a fun, funny show to listen to, but enjoy the show, and have a nice night.
All right, you too, take care. Probably living happily ever after, integrated with Bigfoot society. I don't know. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art. How are you?
Fine.
Listen, I've been listening to you for the past, couple months or so. I was privileged to find you. I put together what I think is going on, including discontinuity, UFOs, government cover-up, the big secret,
you can
genetic altering.
You can fit all that into one egg?
Out.
Really?
I figured it out. Seriously.
Okay. What is it?
A DNA helix has been removed. We are being controlled by a very, very technologically advanced... I'm getting nervous.
Why?
Because I believe what I'm saying. I have
Then you shouldn't be nervous at all.
I'm not used to talking on the radio. I'm used to selling it. I used to sell radio for a living.
A DNA helix has been removed, and we're controlled by a very advanced what?
An extremely advanced intelligence that comes from, I believe, a place near the Pleiades.
Let me interject here. What makes you believe all this?
Well, I'll talk about intuition. I have opened myself up to the concept. I've embraced the concept that we are not alone for a long time.
But what I mean is, how do you
know? I've never been visited or, you know, abducted or anything like that.
I understand. You're doing this intuitively.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I live right in between two Great Lakes in a little place called Lewiston, New York.
Right.
All my life, I grew up in Niagara Falls. I live out here in a suburb now. And I have led a very interesting life. Both my parents died by the time I was 10 years old. Come from a very large family that's extremely dysfunctional, but intuitively psychic. Incredibly. We get this from my mother's side of the family.
Well, it seems like a lot of dysfunctional people are psychic.
Anyway, well, we go hand in hand because we don't know how to deal with
it. What I mean to ask you is, how do you know that what you are intuitively feeling is real?
I put it all together.
As opposed to... Please let me finish.
I'm sorry.
As opposed to something that you're cooking up in your own mind.
There's much, much, much too much scientific evidence to prove it.
For example?
Pick a topic. Cover-up? Why have they not wanted us to find this out? Because the powers that be have controlled us for a long time.
That's a theory. That's not scientific evidence.
Talking about a bunch of gold diggers, like you mentioned to your friend the other day, who was talking about the Sumerians, and
yes.
That's all true.
Oh, yes.
That's absolutely true. In rock.
All right, well, see, now, all right, well, listen, I appreciate your call, but I really object to the presentation of something as fact. I'm willing to consider anything. But when you say, I've got scientific evidence that proves it, and I say, okay, for example, what? And then you present a theory rather than a fact, I begin to have a problem with that. I thought the man who discussed that theory of evolution was absolutely fascinating. Do I embrace that automatically as fact and claim scientific evidence for it? No, I do not. And so I sort of object to the way you approach this call. If you want to call and say something is a theory, and you want to present it as that, then we've got common ground to talk. If you call and say, my theory is fact and proven scientifically, and then I ask you for the science that you just said, and what I get is a theory, then we part our ways. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hey, Art, how you doing?
Doing fine.
Good, good. This is James in Hollywood.
Yes, James.
Hi. I sent you a couple weeks ago. I don't really know what I'm calling to tell you, but I... A couple weeks ago, I sent you a fax. I saw this crazy thing over the skies in L.A.
Yeah.
And it was like I had a little animation, or not an animation, but a little illustration in the fax. It was I like referenced First Contact.
I'm not quite sure what you're talking about yet.
Anyway, I sent you a fax. It was like a couple weeks ago, before the night that there was the big sighting over Seattle. It was actually a week before that Friday. I was sitting on Melrose in Hollywood.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, but I get hundreds and hundreds of faxes.
Right, right. Anyway, so how's it going?
Fine.
Okay, all right. Well, anyway, no, I just called I missed the show tonight pretty much. I'm going to catch it on the replay. But I was wondering if you could just briefly give me the lowdown on that, how the guy called in and said he tickled the area or whatever?
Well, no, I really couldn't do that briefly.
It's not a brief thing.
No, well, we laid it out over a period of 3 hours. Well, let me see. Could I do it in a nutshell? Basically, Neil Slade described a mental way for you to turn on the area of your brain that allows things like telekinesis, telepathy, those sorts of things, which Princeton University, by the way, has, I believe, and they believe, proven beyond any shadow of a doubt to be true, that our brains can do these things. And Neil Slade simply came up with a way for you, without invasive surgery or something like that, to be able to flip the switch that allows you to enter those areas. That's the best I can do in a nutshell. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi.
Oh, I'd like to relate an experience that I had when Lee R. Harvey Oswald got shot.
Where are you calling from, sir?
Minneapolis.
First time caller, huh?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I've listened for quite a while.
Okay.
Quite interested. This has been an experience that I've related to very few people, but I was about 18 miles from my home, and I went to work on a Sunday morning and doing a lot of extra work preparing for Monday. And I had the radio on, and I heard a news flash that they were going to release Lee Harvey Oswald from the jail and transfer him.
Well, not release, you mean transfer, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I got this feeling of just hot sweat, and I knew that he was going to be shot. I called my wife. I said, Mother, put that television on. I'm coming home as fast as I can get there. They're going to kill Lee Harvey Oswald. And I got in that car, and I flew with that car as fast as I could get home, turned on the TV, and just sat there and just sweat. And I just knew that it was going to happen. And this is the experience that I had. So I've had three others exactly the same situations, only in different cases, of course.
Well, that would be a case, sir, of, thank you, precognition. And yes, these things are real. I, too, as I explained in some painful detail earlier, have had something like that occur to me, so they are real. The question is, how do we actually access these areas? How do we promote these abilities? How do and I think Neil Slade is on to something. Hey, Art, check out CNN headline news for a rather disturbing report about dolphins off the coast of Florida having a rare and very deadly cancer. Yet another bite on the butt from Mother Nature. Are you feeling sometimes these days that the quickening is happening just a little too quickly for comfort? Yes, Stefan, I am. But that was the whole point of the book in the first place, and it's a lot more than a book. It's actually a process that is underway right now. Dolphins, huh? I will check into it. West of the Rockies, you're on the air.
Ah, hi. Mike from Chicago on WLS.
Hi, Mike.
About Neil's, the one thing that you had a problem with Neil's theory was that he claims it can only be used for good.
That's correct.
And I think the problem there is maybe just that Neil hasn't really investigated that area too much and certainly would like to believe that it's used for good because the power is basically good, but not in the human sense.
I thought the rest of his presentation was right on the money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, good and evil are typically, are exclusively human terms. We don't find that sort of concept probably in the animal kingdom. It may well
be that Neil, or the good in Neil, could not imagine this to be used for anything evil.
That's certainly the way that that he would feel naturally. But well, when you become enlightened, you discover that good and evil are more than just are simply man's concepts, and that basically nature, the good in nature is the fact that it does things naturally. And if you become enlightened, you tend not to to care about doing evil things. You won't necessarily care about doing good things. You just care about doing enlightened things. The only way that you could use this power for evil is if you were became enlightened through the pursuit of, say, evil, like a magician or a witch or something like that.
Sure.
And then you discovered this power. You'll become enlightened, but still are on the track of evil.
I think you're right on the money, and I very much appreciate your call. I see I'm behind, so we'll be right back. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
All right, this is Haley in Oxford, Michigan.
Hi there.
I'd like to tell you that I'm really looking forward to your acquisition of a new station here in the Detroit area.
We're on the way.
Boy, trying to listen to that Philadelphia station is really hit and miss.
Yeah, from Michigan, I can imagine it would be.
Yeah. I'd like to emphasize what that one of your last callers said about the dualistic nature of creation. You know, we've positive and negative aspects, and human view of taking the negative bad and the positive good. But it takes two ends of the same stick, you know, to create this illusion that we perceive as reality. So, he's right on the money that it's primarily what we hope to be the right case. There's also there's a left-hand approach to God as well as a right-hand approach. And I'm just wondering what your friend Harlot will have to say about her abilities with regard to this process you're talking about.
Well, as I said to a caller, I think, yesterday, I now have somebody who has sent me a fax who claims that Harlot, compared to her, is a Girl Scout.
Well, I'm sure that those people are out there. You know, one of the greatest proponents of the Buddhist...
Listen, sir, I wish we could continue, but my program is over.
Okay.
There is only time for you to say, you know, get the honors.
Good night, everybody. You're listening to Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nigh.
That's the way to do it. Good night, all.